Thank you. Coming up next is Jim Froyen, Back of the Book. Thank you, Steve, for calling. I'm glad you enjoy the music break. And if you enjoy this type of music, on Sunday, Sugar My Bowl returns. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Hi, this is Alec Baldwin. You're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Anything can happen.
Support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Today will be a good day. I gotta make it that way, yeah, yeah.
On Sunday, March 4th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature composer and song stylist Diane Reeves. Tune in to hear a little bit about this amazing force in music. That's Sunday, March 4th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
People of Earth, attention.
We interrupt this alien announcement for the following bulletin. Back of the Book, the radio program that convention defies, will return to the air on Saturday, March 3rd at 5 a.m. Join R. Paul Martin and Pickles of the North for 55 minutes of whatever. We now return you to your alien invasion.
Martian black smoke spreading faster. It leaks Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, Hour of the Wolf. Okay, file. It would be nice if you played. Coming up next.
Good morning. This is not Earthwatch. I am not Robert Knight. I am Jim Freund, but I am here in place of Robert Knight, in a very strange way, working with Robert Knight, or at least working with the powers that be at WBAI to be doing a combination of Earthwatch and Hour of the Wolf with my close friend.
sailor loved me, but he was not a sailor who sailed on the wide blue sea. He sailed in an airship, sailed like a bird on the wing, and every evening at midnight he would come to my window and sing, come take a trip in my airship, come sail away to the stars, we'll travel to Venus, we'll sail away to Mars. No one will see while we're kissing, no one will know as we swoon, so come take a trip in my airship and we'll visit the man in the moon. Sailing away from the clouds, we passed through the milky white way, while idly drifting, watching the clouds, he asked if I'd name the day. Just by the dipper I gave him my heart, the sun shone on our honeymoon, we swore to each other we never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my airship,
come sail away to the stars,
we'll travel to Venus,
we'll sail away to Mars.
No one will see why.
Suffice it to say that Rick Bowes knows everything. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And let me just say, what a pleasure it was to have some really good jazz on the air in the last period of time. It used to be, as Joyce said, a regular thing that we had that on our air. We used to, I know you're listening, Tony Bates, we used to have it every day from 10 to midnight. If I said the next line, I'd be in trouble. Like, we don't need a news rebroadcast. That would really get me into trouble. So I'm not going to say that. Okay. First of all, again, thank the powers that be for enabling tonight's special. Thank the power that be, that is Robert Knight, for allowing this. What happened was a few weeks ago, many millennia ago, before the thon began, it was January, I mentioned that I was going to be having a reading next Tuesday, but more of that later, and probably some people on the air discussing Under the Moons of Mars to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the book originally called, I think it was called Under the Moons of Mars, John Joseph Adams and Genevieve Valentine Nod. Yes, as all of you watching your radios can tell. And, I'm going to, by the way, I have to do a Google Hang once during this. I should have started it tonight. As of 9 minutes ago, everybody's privacy is gone. So we should have started that tonight. But anyway, and Robert said, Barsoom, I love that stuff. And I said, cool. Let's co-host it. And, you know, ever since my show was canceled and I was put on at 1:30 a.m. to 3, I'm sorry, Tony, you know I have to do that. And Tony worked out a new time slot for me rather than left me hanging in the wind. All right, does that make up for it? Okay. And it is really cool following Robert. Ever since then, I've wanted to actually collaborate with Robert, just as, you know, other than Robert saying, yes, okay, do 3 hours and have Ellen Kushner on or something like that, which he's done for me, which is just way cool. And I thought that this would be very good for John Carter. But then came up a specter that, well, Robert did remember John Carter, but he was very, very young when he read these books, and he didn't remember them too well. And in talking with our PA director, Kathy Davis, and Robert and all that, a bit of a specter came up, which is the fact that these books were written in, 100 years ago, less 2 weeks. And, I would say the attitude was not totally progressive even for 1912. It just wasn't, you know, really that, well, progressive. I think another word for what some of the stuff could be, especially with the Tarzan books, might be, what, to be fair, unmitigatingly, totally racist beyond belief.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that's a reasonable term.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Robert is not just a talk show host. Robert is also a pivotal news personality and pundit and an advocate of certain things. And until he knows what this movie looks like, what the news stories that we are here to discuss based on what Burroughs created in his era concerned, he wanted to step back. So he's not co-hosting tonight, but what I extracted out of him was a likely promise, and I do hope this will happen, that after he has seen the movie and we've all had a chance to take it in, that he and I do a show together, having the very, I'm going to use the word argument in the best sense of the word, you know, the Talmudic sense of the word. And everything Robert Knight does is Talmudic, in really the studious sense of the word. The argument being, at one point he said something that just floored me. He said, yes, this may not be racist or this or that, but do you really want to show young black people today Norman Rockwell? And it's like, well, that's a very cogent point, and it just totally shut me up, because, yes, he's absolutely right. So, no, that's not, you know, that kid in the dentist chair is not racist. The illustrator looking at himself is not racist. It's just this all pure, perfectly heirs of the perisphere white. Genevieve is nodding. She recognizes Who wrote that story? It's in Mirror Shades, edited by Bruce Sterling. It's the first story in the book. It's William Gibson. And just those fabulous stories. I like Gibson's short fiction more than his long fiction. And And it's about this writer slash photographer for a National Enquirer type of magazine who is seeing out of his peripheral vision the future as it was seen in 1939, the streamlined future, and it is white. It's not sparkling silver. It is white. And it's a brilliant, brilliant story. And that's the kind I was telling Robert about it. So one day, Robert and I are going to combine forces and have that discussion about, you know, retro racism, or I don't know what to call it.
Racism is racism.
It is, but what happens 100 years later? You were talking to Kathy earlier, Genevieve.
Yes.
And you had a phrase that was just brilliant.
I was talking about the fact that when I was asked to do the anthology, I read the first three Barsoom novels, and it is unmitigated racism and unmitigated sexism everywhere that you look. And there's no overcoming that, and there's no excusing that. And the only thing you can do, and I think what the best stories of this anthology have done, is interrogate what Edgar Rice Burroughs was doing rather than just recreate what he was doing. And I think that that's necessary, and probably the only way that this text can be looked at without sliding backwards.
John, you've been dominating the air so much. John Joseph Adams is a wonderful anthologist. He used to be on the show all the time till he went west, bought a publishing company, or founded.
Bought.
Went
the founding editor, and then later became the publisher as well.
Do me a favor and pull the mic closer to you. Tap the microphone. All right. Okay, yeah, it is working, but it's low. Okay, fine.
It's just his dulcet tones, that's all.
Yeah. Actually went the route of a former colleague of yours, Gordon Van Gelder. John used to be at the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, and Gordon bought. He liked it so much, he bought the magazine. And John has done a similar thing, putting out these wonderful anthologies, theme anthologies, and has now actually bought a publishing company. But the company you bought is not Simon & Schuster.
Right. Yeah, you know, I edit Lightspeed Magazine and recently became publisher of Lightspeed Magazine as well. So that's what Jim is referring to.
And Lightspeed is an online webzine found at thelightspeed.com.
Well, lightspeedmagazine.com.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Who has lightspeed.com?
I think it's some sort of...
Squatter.
No. There's some company that has it. It's like, I think it has something to do with stocks or something. I don't really remember.
Most of them do have something to do with stocks now, so yeah. That sounds accurate.
Yeah. You know, it's some legitimate company, but nothing to do with me, alas.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would definitely have Lightspeed.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Lightspeed, in this last year, had a whole bunch of stories nominated for Nebula Awards.
Yeah, we had three this year, so that was pretty exciting.
In the sophomore year of the magazine.
Yeah. Yeah, we had two last year, which was great, and then three this year. So
that's pretty darn good.
Yeah.
But, you know, that would be about as rare as somebody coming out with, let's say, a first-time novel and having that nominated. Oh, Genevieve, I'm so happy.
Thank you.
Mechanique is this wonderful novel that everybody who listens to WBAI all the time and has heard Genevieve on this program has heard you read, I think, twice from it. No, you didn't let me play the reading from Capclave.
I think that was fair. That was not me at my best, but I do believe I have read from it for you.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. But the Capclave thing you did not want me to play for some reason.
Somehow when you read it sitting in a hotel room, some of the magic is gone.
I don't know about that. I think there's a different dynamic, which is actually very cool, the fly on the wall kind of a thing. And so Genevieve's first novel, Mechanic, which you can read more about at GenevieveValentine.com.
Sounds good.
Was nominated for the Nebula Award for Best Novel of the Year. And this is not just an I have more respect for the Nebulas than for the Hugos insofar as that's a peer award. The Hugo is a fan award. The fan awards are great. They really talk about popularity and what the zeitgeist is that's out there and all that. But the Nebula Award are other writers saying, welcome to the fold of being one of the best. You don't have to respond.
Thank you.
Okay, so all I have to say is, we knew it all the time.
Thank you very much.
And so to each of you, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, should I – no, let's not start screaming phone numbers. Let's tell people – it's amazing how few people know who John Carter of Mars or Not is. I went to some of the fellow we saw out there and said, well, we're going to be talking about John Carter. And, you know, he's one of the few people who didn't say, oh, Noah Wiley from ER. Or have you ever noticed how every science fiction show has a Carter in it?
That's true. Hmm. Now that we're thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's Stargate, one of the Trek shows, I think the last one had a Carter in it.
X-Files had Chris Carter.
That's right.
Does that count?
Yes.
Yeah, it does. And especially because wasn't there an episode in which somebody played him?
I think so. I think that was when they were unspooling the meta as fast as they could in an attempt to get to sweeps week. They were like, quick, we don't have enough mythology.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a Carter even in the X-Files and so on and so forth. But John Carter, the Disney has been advertising, is the original space opera hero. You were going to say something.
I was going to say, where do I even begin with John Carter? First of all, they took off the of Mars, which just from a marketing perspective is a huge mistake, because then people can only assume they're looking at a Star Wars ripoff and they do not understand that this is actually what Star Wars came from. Second of all, after the initial teaser trailer came out, they conveniently cut the fact that John Carter is, in fact, a Confederate soldier, which is going to be really hard for them to get around because there's just no way
out.
But
it does explain his utter racism.
Oh, my God. There's just no way out with Burroughs. Like, everywhere you turn, it's just unacceptable ideas and clawing your own face.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see how the movie does it, but in the same way one is interested to see the slow motion version of a horrible car crash, where as long as you know that no one was actually injured, you're very interested to see how many times the car flips over.
But this has a good pedigree. I mean, aside from the Burroughs, aside from the old pedigree, this movie.
The screenwriting and the directing, I will absolutely agree with you. Let's keep in mind that in the trailer, which they are trying to draw people in with, the two big lines of dialogue are as follows. You are John Carter of Earth? And then, yes, ma'am. And that's what they're using to get you into the theater.
And it is totally imperialistic. Let's just point that out.
You think?
You know, because the political message does seem to be, if we let these, whatever color, I think it's the... No, I always forget. Is it the green Martians or the blue Martians?
No one likes the green Martians. The blue Martians are the ones that are trying to blow up the power station. And the trailer has Tars Tarkas. Thank you, John. Basically shouting to everyone of his kind, here is the man who will save us. So you get a nice helping of what these people need is a honky. And that's just a trailer. I mean, TM to Tempest Bradford for that, by the way, if she's listening. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she gets a lot of TMs.
Yeah, she does. She's very good at that.
Yeah. I was at a computer trade show where somebody dropped a glass and it broke on the floor, and Tempest just looked up and shouted, Mazel Tov! And every time since I hear this glass dropping, I...
Nice.
I should follow that with TM.
Tempest. TM. Yeah. TM Tempest. That said, however, There is something about the shot of John Carter looking up completely awestruck at the double moons of Mars that gives you like the old school sci-fi chill of being on another world and getting to see what no one else will get to see. So depending on how it is handled, it might just be a totally ham-fisted trailer that is hiding a very interesting exploration of identity that does not shy away from any of the problems and instead confronts them. And if so, I think that has the potential to be a very interesting movie.
And my great hope for it is that ever since I saw WALL-E, and this is probably an argument for another show, and I hope I'm not going to start something wicked here with Genevieve, who is, by the way, one of the best movie bloggers around, who I'm trying to get to be doing regular movie reviews for WBAI, if not for Hour of the Wolf, for other spots or what. We'll work that out. I thought WALL-E was one of the best films of the first decade of the new millennium. John says no.
It depends how big a list we're making. I wouldn't argue with you. I think that it is a much better and more effective silent film than The Artist. I think that
couldn't agree more.
Thank you. I think that it is a more effective film about robot sentience and feelings than most of the ones that have tried that in the past decade. We could make an argument about Simone, but it would have to be a very strange argument because that movie tried for a lot and fell very short.
Nichol, what has happened to you?
I was so hoping In Time would be good.
No.
I can see we're geeking off into the last time the two of you were here.
It was a series of tangents. For a million hours.
With Tron Legacy. Do not know why the two of you went to see that.
You had to know. You had to know what they were. You did.
I don't have to know what I stepped in when I feel my shoe feeling a particular way. I just want to scrape it off, you know?
There's no way you can argue with that. Like, we're done. There's no topping that. But no, I agree with you. I think WALL-E was a fantastic film. On the other hand, Andrew Nichol came out with In Time. Like, it is entirely possible for a director to have a concept and not execute it correctly.
Yeah, well, his best film is still his first.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
By a long shot,
amazing
yeah.
Amazing film.
Yeah.
Amazing film.
Which is what makes it so sad. Like seriously, what has happened to you, dude? Like, what?
Gattaca was amazing. Yeah. Simone had a great idea, and you could see where he was going. And In Time was one of those things where you can tell the log line was really, really cool. Mm-hmm. And then the execution, they were just like, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know.
Yeah, I'm guessing the suits are what happened to Andrew Nichol. I'm hoping, giving him
credit. I won't argue with that.
I will note that he was credited as writer, director, and producer of In Time, though. So, I mean, wouldn't the suit be himself?
No.
I guess the executive producer.
There's still a funder.
Yeah, yeah.
There's still a funder, and those are the
I just want to blame
suits.
Him. I want to blame someone for it because I lost
Because
two
you spent
hours
2 hours of your life watching Justin Timberlake.
I did.
That movie was almost hilariously bad, and then the last 10 minutes happened, and you were just like, I have been conned into seeing this film.
And I was 2 years ago I was saying the big movie of the next year would be Avatar. Nobody had heard of Avatar. Mm-hmm. And I got to say I told you so. And last year I said it would be In Time. Mm. And now I'm here to say they told me so.
Yeah. You know, Harlan Ellison had sued the producers of In Time over
Repent Harlequins
yeah,
on TikTok.
Right. Claiming that it stole the concept and whatnot, and I noticed that he dropped the lawsuit at some point. I wonder if it's because he saw it and saw it was so terrible.
It is. He saw the movie, decided he would rather not be associated with it, and dropped the lawsuit.
It's like, I don't even want to win this lawsuit. I don't want my name associated with that forever.
Yeah, let's see what James Cameron has coming up next. I'll sue him again.
I will make no comment on that subject.
Yeah, exactly. But. Get the pedigree of this John Carter movie is that Andrew Stanton is a really good director. I mean, I even liked Finding Nemo. The Gulls. Mine. I mean, it's...
And I don't disagree. I think that this movie has a great pedigree until we get to the source material. And then you have a lot of problems that the movie has to be able to handle really well.
But then who does one get to write the screenplay? He asked leadingly.
Right. Well, you know, Michael Chabon wrote the screenplay, and you know, he's been a longtime fan, and I actually just interviewed him the other day, and
For your podcast?
Yeah, for Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, airing on Wired.com. you know, I was just speaking with him, and it's very clear that, you know, John Carter is near and dear to his heart, and he, like, you know, loved it his entire life, basically. And so, you know, and he's acknowledged these same problems that, you know, we're talking about here, that, you know, the source material obviously has some things that if you're going to adapt it, you need to update. So, I mean, I think, you know, obviously all we have to judge is from the trailer, but, I mean, you know, so we don't really know how successful they are at doing it, but, you know, I think that he certainly is attempting to, you know, correct some of these problems that the Barsoom novels have and translate it to a contemporary audience, which is, I mean, basically the same thing that we're trying to do with the anthology, is, you know, erase the problematic aspects by take the great adventure, take the great sense of wonder stuff that is in those books, and you know, present it to a new generation, but, you know, maybe, like, try to fix some of the problems that you know, the original source material has.
Not that Disney doesn't usually slavishly stick to its source material. Excuse me. Hairball.
And I'm hoping the movie doesn't just erase. Like, and I think that the best stories in this anthology also don't erase. Right. I think they address.
Yeah.
Which is the key difference between just trying to pretend bad stuff never happened and actually bringing a story forward thematically, so that it's
I agree. Yeah, okay. I think Kat Valenti's story in the book is probably the one that does it most directly. That story actually is told from the Tharks' point of view, and it basically is saying that, you know, what John Carter has told you about us is not accurate, and here's the actual story of our people, and so it sort of works on a. You know, to an amazing extent, like, you know, it works as a criticism of Burroughs and yet fits canonically in with the original material quite well. And so I thought it was a great, you know, sort of a neat trick to pull off as a writer to manage both of those things, to satisfy the fans of the original books, but then also to critique it at the same time. And
so, okay, so now let's backtrack just a little, because we have now told people who John Carter is.
Yes.
We have told people who Edgar Rice Burroughs is, and how March 9th is the 100th anniversary of the publication of the first of the Burroughs books, which was Under the Moons of Mars, and then was retitled John Carter.
A Princess of Mars.
John Carter of Mars, I think it's like the 10th book in the series or something, according to Larry.
Mm.
Well, one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
They were pulling it out right before Sweeps Week.
That was it. That was it. That was the 20s by then, yeah. We have to talk off air about The Artist and versus Hugo, and how one is pro-silent movies and one is anti-silent movies. Well, that's a whole other thing.
That was my commentary on The Artist, but you couldn't hear it because it was silent.
There we go. So we've described those, but we have not yet described the book that finally came out under the title Under the Moon of Mars. Mm. We're discussing it, but we haven't said what it is. John, what is it?
Yeah, so the full title, I guess, would be Under the Moons of Mars, New Adventures on Barsoom, the subtitle sort of tells you what it is, but okay.
I'm going to ask you to make another mic adjustment. Since you keep looking at Genevieve, I want you to pull the mic to the other side. So that, perfect.
Okay.
Now when you talk to her, you'll still be on mic.
I apologize.
No, don't. That's fine.
I apologize for making all those faces.
Okay, so,
I should be filming this.
Under the Moons of Mars, you know, it's 14 new stories, you know, written by all contemporary writers. As I was saying, it's, you know.
Somebody should do a reading of that.
Yeah, maybe we can find one of the authors and get them to read something from
or
that.
Or two. Today.
Yeah. Two?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you mean on the show?
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I meant today.
Oh, yes, today,
yeah,
absolutely.
Mean,
next
week, maybe we'll have two of them meet up in some public venue where people can come and listen.
Semi-public.
Yeah. But yeah, so the anthology, it's, you know, it contains 14 new stories and also a... It has a pretty great gazetteer, as it's called here. But it's, so basically a glossary of Barsoomian terms and whatnot by the great Richard Lupoff. You know, he's a scholar. I mean, he's a writer of science fiction. But
he's a radio personality from KPFA. Let's deal with it, okay? He's from Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. You know, he's been on the air as long or longer than me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because when I was working for Baird Searles in the late 60s, Dick Lupoff was already on KPFA.
Mm.
And never mind that he was really cool writer and scholar, but yeah. But yeah. I like to bring that up every so often. But sorry, go on.
Yeah. You know, I mean, he's written extensively about Burroughs, and he's like one of the foremost experts on Burroughs in the world, I would guess. But so he wrote this great, sort of glossary for people who are maybe new to Barsoom or just haven't read it in quite a while. But so, you know, it features the anthology features stories by like Jonathan Mayberry, Catherine M. Valenti, S.M. Sterling, of course, Genevieve Valentine that's here with us, Peter S. Beagle, Joe R. Lansdale, and others. All the stories are actually illustrated as well. Like
by the
likes
great
of,
illustrators.
Yeah,
aren't
like
they amazing?
Yeah, Charles Vess, Gregory Manchess, you know, Molly Crabapple, Mike Cavallaro, you know, John Picasso. Yeah, a lot of great contemporary artists. So, I mean, it's... you know, in a very wide range of styles,
like
too.
Like Luda.
Yeah, yeah. So
great names.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it was a lot of fun to put together. It was a great honor to obviously work with some of these artists and authors. So, you know, as I was saying, I mean, you know, the idea was sort of to, you know, to tell new adventures of Barsoom, but to also, as we were discussing, you know, sort of try to correct some of these or interrogate, you know. These issues that we have had with Barsoom. I mean, it was sort of a difficult book to know who to approach about because, well, A, on the one hand, you don't know who's a fan because, you know, it's like sometimes some people wear their influences on their sleeve, some people don't. And then, but then there's also the case of like someone like Genevieve or Kat Valenti, where I could assume that they would have obvious issues with the original source material and like, well, how are they going to take that? Like, are they interested in it? Or, you know, would that just put them off too much? Or, and I mean, there's plenty of people like that who like, you know, I wouldn't even know until I ask and, you know,
I mean, it would be amazing. I'm just thinking of the second volume of this.
Yeah.
You know, you got to get something in there by, oh, Tempest or Nora Jemison or, you know.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's the interesting thing about something like this is that, you know, there's, as Genevieve was saying, it's like, you know, there's no reason to pretend that this stuff never happened or never existed. And it's like, if you confront it, that makes it better. You know, that opens up the discussion. And, while in a way I could see it saying, well, you are sort of glorifying the source material by honoring it in this way and, you know, continuing it. And so maybe that's a slight negative. But, I mean, the thing is those books are out there in the world. You know, if you continue if you sort of open up the discussion, that can only be good rather than a negative. So
it's absolutely true. And what's more, there are things to be fixed. There are things that, okay, Robert Knight loved Barsoom mm-hmm. when he was little, but he cannot – with integrity, tell listeners to call now mm-hmm. and obtain a copy of this book by pledging $75 to WBAI without really knowing a great deal about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I go the other way. I say, no, it is time for the young people today to take a Barsoom into their hearts or some Barsooms. What's the plural? Barsoomi, some Barsooms into their hearts and therefore have a new experience. We should point out that this is, technically speaking, mm-hmm. this is a young adult
right,
collection.
Yeah. It's actually like 10 and up is how they're marketing it, which is sort of an in-between between middle grade and YA. But like 10 and up is – I mean I've actually seen it usually in the actual science fiction section as opposed to the young adult section.
It's a science fiction / fantasy book.
Yeah.
And to call it YA to me is important because it means it's easier for me to read without my glasses. you know, better fonts,
right,
better typefaces. But as you can tell, I'm trying to segue a little, which is to say we're going to the point where we have to remember that the reason that we're able to talk about this cool stuff and that we're going to be able to hear Genevieve read and give a nod of the hat to David Barkirtley, who was going to be here to read, but the weather just was too daunting. Mm-hmm. But y'all can hear him on Geek's Guide to the Galaxy anyway, and we may do that later. Because Simon and Schuster has, out of the goodness of their heart, donated 25 copies of this book to WBAI. Now, that is just way cool. Very often when you hear us, you know, pushing premiums about, well, whatever they may be, and there's a lot of controversy about some of them, these are often things that it's commonplace for some of the producers to go and, in essence, purchase them at a nice discount, because we are a nonprofit educational institution here, and then have the formula is, I've always found this strange, but apparently it's one that works, 10 times the cost to us. So if, for example, Simon & Schuster didn't give these to us and we had to pay the cover price less, say, 50%, we would be spending approximately $10 each, and we would have to ask for a $100 donation in order to give this to you for free. Let's get that straight. Premiums are not sold. You give us money out of the goodness of your heart and out of the goodness of our heart. We will give you a copy of the book. But Simon & Schuster was just way cool. And we're not buying from Simon & Schuster. They actually donated outright 25 copies to us, which is, you know, before it would be, this book is published by Simon & Schuster. And this way it's, thank you, Simon & Schuster. Thank you very much, particularly your publicist who made this happen, Sienna.
I don't actually know how to pronounce her last name, so I'd rather not try.
Then we're going to just thank Sienna, Simon & Schuster.
There's probably only one Sienna at Simon & Schuster who's a publicist,
probably,
I would guess.
Probably. Well, one way or the other, thank you, folk. But let's not precipitate that. What we need to do is we need to start getting you folks to call up and to appreciate that there aren't a whole lot of radio stations that, even if we were going out and promoting a new Disney film or books based on it, not taking, shall we say, both a fun and realistic, I won't say scholarly, but a realistic approach. This is like squeaky hammer time off. Now I get to be stupid, Genevieve. After 1 o'clock, you get to like bop me again when I fall off the rails.
Deal.
Okay, last time I was here, I was like stepping on everything she was trying to say, and she had the courage and courtesy to tell me about it afterward. Most other people have just walked away grumbling.
I believe in flipping the table. When you're angry, just flip the table and get it over with and then set everything
and
back up.
And this time, if I do it again, she'll flip the bird. But anyway, and the bird's in the next studio right now. Anyway, the point is that we are here, that we were given the airtime between Robert Knight and the programming departments of WBAI to raise money. It is also to have fun. It is also to hear fiction read. It's also to discuss movies. And Genevieve has a informal review for us in a little while. But first and foremost on the list is why we are gathered here today. We are gathered here today in the name of WBAI, John Carter, John Joseph Adams, Genevieve Valentine, and Tony Bates to keep this freaking radio station alive. And we have a very, very, very cool way of doing it. We give you a phone number. You call that number, make a pledge, and you will get a copy of this book Under the Moons of Mars. And if you're one of the first people to call, there's a 2.5 to 1 chance. No, a 1 out of 2.5 chance that your copy will be autographed by John and by Genevieve. And, we might even be able to work it out that if you pay your pledge at an upcoming event about this book, you can get more autographs from other writers in the book as well. That just occurred to me. But I can guarantee that 9 copies of the book, it's 10, but I took one, because they're giving us actually 26 and we're moving 25. 9 copies of the book are autographed. You know, so in terms of the whole big situation out there, that means that at least 9 of you will have autographed copies of the book and the others will just have good copies of the book. Thank you so much for being here. Who has been holding down the tally?
Carol's in there now.
Carol's in there now. Carol. And right. And you are?
I'm Helena.
Thank you, Helena. Thank you so much. We've only met on Facebook before.
No, but it's so nice to meet you in person.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
Take care.
Have a great show.
Yeah, thank you. And during the thons, all bets are off. And we have to remember. It's how I started at WBAI, by the way, was as a phone volunteer. I talk about, oh, my God, May 1st. It will have been, anybody care to guess? How many years?
50.
No, 45.
45.
45 years. I'm not that old. Or I wasn't that young. Well, I was 13.
I knew you were super young when you started.
I was 13. Yeah. I was 13. But that was just answering phones.
Yeah. I thought you started at 8. I mean, I'm sorry.
No, that's my Facebook picture. That's my little Facebook picture. But we just have the 40th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf.
Mm.
Where Margot Adler came on and hosted this show in January. And that was way cool. So anyway, now, if you call now and pledge and say thank you for 40 years of this science fiction program and the 10 years before that of the science fiction programs produced by Baird Searles and the years before that by Anthony Boucher. Well, he actually just did opera programs, but for God's sake, it was Anthony Boucher was our music director. And for those who know science fiction and mystery books, these are just like cool names. The first person I worked with when I came to WBAI was Samuel R. Delaney. And I met Theodore Sturgeon and Tom Dish. And this is like, you know, the story I like to tell and I tell all the time is when people like David Hartwell, and I'm not sure that he was the first, saying the golden age of science fiction was 13 as opposed to 19, whatever. Mm-hmm. I say, yeah, that was me. I came here to WBAI and I worked with Joanna Russ. And, you know, I mean, this just turns your head. And, you know, it doesn't make me a living, but it turned my head. And it's just such a wonderful thing. And WBAI is such an amazing and wonderful place that I am able to come in and actually do this thing. That there are people who will actually allow me to create this on the air. And there are people out there who will actually listen. And who will actually pledge. That's where you, the listener, come in. Is that right now, you will pick up that phone. You will pick up that phone. Go to the window. Leo McKern jokes. I don't know why. Genevieve gets it.
Top secret?
Help.
Help! I'm the worst! I just saw help again.
I need somebody. Help. Not just
anybody.
Yeah, help.
The coolest sunken living room that has ever appeared on film.
It really is. It really is. But Leo McKern is so wonderful. Him and Eleanor Braun, they make that movie for me. Those other guys, the Beatles. Oh, I've got to play a Davy Jones song this morning, don't I? I like Davy Jones, and I know what song it is I'm going to have to play. But anyway. Help. We need somebody. not just anybody, you, the listener. Call up now, 212-209-2950. There, phone number, call number two, second time I said it. But in the next 12 minutes, I am going to make a really hard, typical hard WBAI hard sell push. 212-209-2950 is the number to call and pledge. We are here till 3 a.m. Is it going to be fun or is it going to be a phone number? 212-209-2950. This is what it's like when it's a phone number. Just saying that over and over and over again. 212-209-2950. At 1 o'clock, if we have made some money, these two guests get to bop me over the head and start talking real radio. But you need to call in order to make that happen, because by that time I'm just going to be hyper and crazy, because that's how you call. But it has happened because John Joseph Adams and Genevieve Valentine are here, thanks to the help of Robert Knight and Kathy Davis and Tony Bates, who made the decision, yes, let us do this thing, even with its shadowy past. And you, the listener, the discerning WBAI listener, recognize that sometimes what you need to do is have fun and at the same time educate and at the same time learn and learn about different views of the world and open the world up, because science fiction and fantasy are about learning about how other people think, learning about broadening your horizons. That is why it is really only listener-sponsored radio and college stations that even attempt to do science fiction radio, podcasts notwithstanding. And even then, Wired is definitely an alternative type thinking place. So this kind of a thing is rare, and this kind of a thing needs to be treasured. But this kind of thing doesn't even happen on public radio. I don't know why not, because it's perfect for public radio. But for some reason, they tend not to do it. They do short stories occasionally. They do, in selected shorts, they do either 13 or 26 a year. And that's an actor reading a writer's work. Here we have writers, the best freaking writers in the world, come in, like we have this morning, come in to read to you. And that's what's going to happen. But in order for this kind of thing to go on, first of all, we need to show the programming department at WBAI, who said that I could be here, that yes, it was worth it because you folks responded and you folks called and pledged. Secondly, we need to simply step back and say this radio station that facilitates and allows this kind of thing to happen is worth having, because if we don't have it, who else can do these kinds of things? Where else can this happen? 212-209-2950 is the number to call. $25 makes you a member of WBAI, and we will very happily take that and thank you for that, $25 and up. But we would be even more thrilled for a $75 pledge, and then you can get this premium. Edgar Rice Burroughs' Under the Moons of Mars, edited by John Joseph Adams, New Adventures in Barsoom, with, frankly, an amazing list of writers and way cool illustrations within. And you'll be doing us a favor, you'll be doing yourself a favor on many levels. You'll be getting the book, you'll be encouraging WBAI to play this kind of programming, and you'll be keeping WBAI alive. 212-209-2950 is the number to call and pledge. Let's get those calls coming in now. 212-209-2950. I see that we have on the tally a current tally of $310, but I've seen that for a while. I'm not sure whether that came in during the show. If that did not come in during the show, tally, please make that a zero. If it did come in, yay. And thank everybody. And at some point, bring in them cards so that I can thank the people. Even if they said, no, I can't read your name on the air, bring those cards in anyway, because I can always say, I'd like to thank, you know, Avenue B in Manhattan or something like that. There are ways of getting around people who don't want their names on the air. After all, this is the Google age. You know, there's no privacy. So 212-209-2950. Please make a call now. Please make a pledge now. I wish Joyce was still here. But if she's sensible, she already left, because I'm not quite sure how this telephone system works. I know. Oh, there. That's how it works. Okay. And I can see that, in fact, we have no calls coming in at this moment. Let us get some calls coming in. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Please call now. Make a pledge. $25, $75, whatever it may be, you'll be sending a message to fans, friends, yourself, and to the management of WBAI and Pacifica Radio that this is programming you encourage. I pointed out earlier that John Joseph Adams mentioned that one of the people called and that one of the people that did entries for this book, Richard A. Loopoff, is this expert in Edgar Rice Burroughs? And I said, he's from KPFA. Well, yes, he is. And where else would he be from? What other radio station would take somebody of that caliber? Mike Hodel, who was a news person here, went to the West Coast and started a show called Hour 25 after he'd done a few episodes of Hour of the Wolf of Margot Adler. Just for those people who say, oh, Mike Hodel was the first person to do this, it's the longest running science fiction show. No. He was on Hour of the Wolf first. So if he was on Hour of the Wolf in New York, how could he have done Hour 25? Hodel died young. It was a terrible, terrible thing. He died of what I call Terry Carr disease. Terry Carr was this brilliant editor who just died too young, as did Mike Hodel. But Hodel's shows continues today as a podcast. Do they still call it Mike Hodel's Hour 25? When Harlan Ellison and Joe Michael Straczynski took the show over for a while, they just called it Hour 25, but then some fans took it over and they called it. The point is, it was a Pacifica radio station. What are the other good science fiction shows in the country? Well, there's Shockwave out of KFAI in Minneapolis by Baron Dave Rahm, and he does a great show. That's Minneapolis, and it's not a Pacifica station, but it is a listener-sponsored radio station. It's not even public radio. It's listener-sponsored radio. And then at Stony Brook, Howard Margolies has his show called Destinies, which is a college station, but again, it's non-commercial radio. The point is, and he's got that because, well, he's been there for years and years and years. Same reason why Phil Schaap, for example, is on WKCR, because they'd be stupid to say, you've graduated, go off the air, when you have somebody that good. So that's true for Howard Margolies as well. But here at WB, now why they haven't gotten rid of me, well, they did get rid of that. Anyway, all that aside, we need to not get rid of me some more. And the way that that's going to happen is with you calling. I see that we got one phone call in. Thank you very much. I don't know if that was a pledge call or not, but let's get some more. 212-209-2950 is the number to call and pledge. $75 we will say, aha. Okay, it's a $25 pledge. Look at that. Which is very cool, because on the one hand, it's like, oh, $25. On the other hand, that's somebody who's not even saying, give me the book right now. That's somebody who's saying, thank you for being on the air. Here's $25. Thank you for that. Now let's make some money. 212-209-2950. Let's move these books. Simon and Schuster have been good enough to donate 25 of these books to WBAI. When we put them on the website after this is over and people can order them through the WBAI website for the benefit of BAI, it will A, not necessarily go to the glory, that is Hour of the Wolf, and B, we may mark it up at that point. 212, and those leftovers, it is the first 9 books that are the autographed ones. There's no guarantee that you will get one of those. Please understand that. But there's a darned good chance. 212-209-2950. I'd like to see some calls come in the next 2.5 minutes, please. 212-209-2950. How often I have to do this during the course of the show depends on your calling in, how often you call in, and how quickly we can move these books. We want to move them. We need to move them. You want them. We need you to do that. WBAI needs you to do that. And by the way, may I point out to the diehard WBAI listeners, this is not the kind of premium that we have been offering throughout the majority of this fundraising drive. Among the premiums we have had, well, actually, there's been some cool stuff, the Hackerspace package that the off-the-hook people have. A show, by the way, may I point out, that had its origins on Hour of the Wolf, when Hour of the Wolf was 5 days a week. And I had Emmanuel Goldstein, he calls himself. I know his real name. Emmanuel Goldstein, a name from Brave New World. I hope you all... Not Brave New World, 1984. Isn't he the evil one of 1984? The other one that in essence, the one who Big Brother is fighting. At any rate, they have packages. We have The Journey. Gary Knoll has been promoting the Coco Magic Love Pack. I don't know what that is, but it deserves to be said as the Coco Magic Love Pack. Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I showed you my Galaxy Nexus last night.
Yes.
Didn't I? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we got... is this a name I can say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Look at the bottom.
May we thank our wolf? I see the name of the person who took the pledge. Oh, I love you, Jim. Oh, that's adorable. Which Jim are they referring to, though, is the question here. But this is from Bertie E.L. Ogiri? Is that how you would pronounce it?
I didn't take it.
Bertie in Staten Island, yes. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Have we moved any of the premium yet?
Not yet.
Not yet. Why not yet? Look at this book. No, don't leave. You can't leave. Look at this freaking book. Tell me that this isn't like one of the coolest premiums we have this year.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially given the competition.
You're not supposed... But you're not the official on the air person, so you can get away with what I was thinking. I mean, with what... with that. 212-209-2950. I know this is right up your alley.
Yeah, this is
good. Yeah. Yeah. It really is. It really is. And it is really worth your donating the $75 to WBAI in order to get this book autographed. You have a good chance of getting an autographed copy. 212-209-2950. It is after 1 a.m. And I'm not going to hold the whole show for ransom, but I want at least one book. We have 25. One book to go. 212-209-2950. We're giving away the book for free if you only give us $75. It's how nonprofits work. You can't sell anything. It's not how it works. Yeah, as I said earlier, you donate money, we give you a premium. I'm not sure why it's called a premium, but that's how it works, and that's what it is. And these books, we didn't buy them. They were donated to WBAI by Simon & Schuster for the purpose of raising money for this radio program and for WBAI itself. And it's almost incidental that it's there to promote the book, because they didn't have to give away any in order to do that. A version of the show would be happening regardless of that, but they are here to help us out, and we want to thank them, and we want to thank you. But what we need to thank you for is for that donation that you have made. I'm now talking an hour in the past, because, you know, in that hour when I wasn't pitching, you gave us thousands of dollars. And I want to thank you so much for your will having done that. 209-2950. I was going into pitch mode, automatic Freund pitch mode. I mean, old phone numbers of WBAI. And one time I just rattled through them and we were getting calls. It turned out that they've been reassigned. You know, even when I was saying Oxford 7 blank, 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 you know, it was like, so all these people were calling me in the middle of the night. It's like, holy, I did not know those numbers were reassigned. It figures, though. 212-209-2950. Got it right that time. 212-209-2950. I would like to see at least one copy, an autographed copy, because I just about guarantee that the next call will get the autographed one, right? We have 9 here now. I took one. There were 10. 212-209-2950. And then, very soon, we can have a movie review coming up. Then we will also have a reading. We'll talk with John about his podcast. And, oh, yes, we have to tell you about the event That will be coming next Tuesday on March 6th at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, with free admission donations accepted there as well. But those donations aren't to WBAI. They're to buy all the readers drinks. Well, actually, dinner should work out. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to pledge your support for WBAI, for Hour of the Wolf. You know, I'm not going to say do it for John Carter, do it for Edgar or whatever. Do it for WBAI. Do it for Hour of the Wolf, for that matter. Do it for the kind of program that isn't just pitching and pledging, well, a lot of the things that we're pitching and pledging at other times. I'm not going to necessarily put those down. I am going to say that this is different. This is very different. This is fun. This is about the idea that informed fun entertains and informs. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's it. That's exactly it. And this has been one of the things that made WBAI so incredibly popular in years past. In the 1970s, we were the most listened to radio station at one time in New York City. Can you imagine that? It's hard to believe. Given all the polarizations of things that have gone on in the meantime, as we find our ways through the polarizing political airwaves of so much other hate radio and things like that. But WBAI has been steadfast and true to bringing you alternative radio. For quite a while, arts radio was off the air at this radio station. Not completely, but it was certainly a bit under the rug. And in recent years, in the last 2 years, arts radio has been coming again to the forefront. And it has been recognized that, yes, we were playing jazz earlier tonight. Thank God we were playing good music. We have music programming back on the station in the mornings. Hour of the Wolf is now in its 41st year on the air. Earthwatch, Robert Knight talks about, he was talking about Betty Boop cartoons a few weeks ago when he wasn't doing Occupy Wall Street, you know, and all that. The point is, people are once again recognizing that, to quote Che Guevara, at the risk of seeming ridiculous, a true revolutionary is propelled by love and humor. Okay, that's good old Che for you. So, 212-209-2950. Let's move one book, all right? One book I am looking to move. 212-209-2950. Let's get that call now. We need that call now so we can move on to other agendas. And then I'll be, well, discussing this with all of you a little bit later. But for now, let's justify moving on with the program now. 212-209-2950. I'm sorry to keep doing this. I warned Genevieve and John. 212-209-2950. This is what thons are about. But how are these thons going to go? Are they going to be just pitch-a-thons where nothing, where usually what you've been hearing the last 3 and 4 weeks in Robert's and my time slot were recordings of other shows that had already been done. And you hear, oh, yes, the phones are ringing and all that. Yeah, that's because those were recorded in the middle of the afternoon. We need to show that there are people listening right now, that you want live radio with content that will also raise money just as well, so that I can compete with the recorded programs, so that Robert can compete with the recorded programs. Although Robert is working so hard doing his 5 p.m. show, and that's part of the reason I think he's happy to take a break at this time. I, on the other hand, am not. I'm a air junkie. And therefore, I want to be on during the fundraising drives. I want to be producing radio that will be fun, that will get you to donate, and keep a presence for me and Speculative Fiction and all these things on the air. But that only happens if you call 212-209-2950 right now. 212-209-2950. I shouldn't complain too much, because with the soft sell pitching, we actually got $310, and with the hard sell, $25. That's a diminishing return. I don't know why. But I've got to say that between 1 and 2 o'clock 4 weeks ago, when I did the one pitch shift, we did $900. Now, that's not like the big thousands and thousands of dollars that we necessarily require each and every fundraising drive, but it was a nice dent. It was something I can be proud of, that I say to the programming department, hey, We succeeded. We need to do that for this morning as well. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Does it work better for you that way? I know we want to go back to the days before area codes. But it's 212-209-2950. Yeah, there was a time when we could just say Oxford 7 blank, 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 blank. Those days are gone, alas. I mean, you can call them. That number, if you can figure out what the blankety blank the blanks are, but it won't get you very far. What will get you far, what will get us further, halfway to the two moons of Mars, or under them anyway, is 212-209-2950. Please let us move this along. I am going to end this one way or the other in exactly 1 minute at 1:10 in the morning. The question is, how successful will we be? And that is up to you. That is up for you to make that phone call right now. I'm also going to make a call out, by the way, to people who are not in New York City. I mean, we get phone calls from Bulgaria. Well, one person, a regular listener from Bulgaria. But I've gotten calls from Boston. I've gotten calls from Australia. One call is coming in. Thank you very much. So especially you out-of-towners, Skype it in. 212-209-2950. You're listening through the graces of stream.wbai.org. And that, by the way, is not something that is free for us to do. Say thank you for that. I am so thrilled that we finally become an international radio station. And I also want to do a lot to improve the stickiness of Hour of the Wolf, podcasting and stuff like that. Something I intend to bend John's ear about later on, because he's such a really cool and successful podcast. And, you know, not nothing, something new, but something that will make Hour of the Wolf more and more available. But to do that, we need your help. We need your call. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. We could keep the radio show on the website if I cut out all the music. I'm not quite ready to do that. It's a copyright issue, but so we need an arsenal. We need funding to prove that the show needs to go somewhere. 212-209-2950. One call was coming in, and I've already gone a few seconds past the promised point. So I'm going to dial it back a little. Breathe, Jim. Breathe. I pity the person who's going to have to use this microphone after me. These windscreens are going to be sopping. Sopping. Oh, it's probably a recorded show after me anyway. That doesn't mean you're off the hook from calling, though. One last time. 212-209-2950. Yeah, I was trying to dry the microphone as I was doing that. Should we take a cut of music to provide a break, or do you want, Genevieve, do you want to talk about a movie, or John, would you like to talk about a podcast? No, not quite yet. Give it 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, Genevieve Valentine will read her short story from Under the Moons of Mars, and then you will know what you didn't get by not calling. Oh, wait, no, you have two more hours in which you can still do it. That will spur you on even further.
No pressure.
None. You don't need... What pressure was there when you were writing Mechanique to say, I'm going to write a Nebula nominee novel?
Honestly, could not have been...
Further.
Thank you. Could not have been further from my mind. And when Kate Baker called me to let me know... Well, when Kate Baker called me, period, it was right before Boscone, where she and I were part of a group reading, and I assumed that she had called me to talk about the group reading. So she called, and I said, hi, Kate, is this about the group reading? And she goes, no. And then I still didn't get it. And finally, she had to explain it. And then I was
Kate Baker, aside from being a podcast queen herself, and not a bad writer, by the way.
Not at all.
Is a official of the Science Fiction Writers of America. I just thought I would explain that to the three people listening who didn't know that.
Yes.
You know, they don't tell the editors anything.
And they tell us not to tell anybody.
I know. And it's like, hey, you know, when they tell you not to tell anybody, it's okay to tell your editors, though.
You know, and that's just what an editor would say to try and get you to spill the beans.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's only right that an editor who purchased these stories, who made these stories happen and published, it is absolutely right to say that even though Lightspeed is 2 years old, it's gotten 5 Nebula nominations. Datla, when she walks in the room, if the award nominations she brought in were with her, she couldn't move anywhere. They'd be that heavy. Same for Gordon and
Gardner,
Oskin, and Sheila.
Yeah.
And all these people, Stan Schmidt, these are the, and let's not even think about Hartwell. It is the editors who say, yes, this will be published, who anoint the material and say, thou art not vanity press. And as a result, by doing that is what gets me to read it. Although some vanity presses, there's a weird fine line even now that some self-published works are very good. But the editors need to be recognized, not just for their nomination. There's no Nebula Award for an editor, because that's clearly a writer's guild.
Mm-hmm.
But there are Hugo Awards, which are always cool.
Mm-hmm.
But the Nebula Award is a peer award, and it is right for an editor to say, oop, I scored 3 this year.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like those are also, like, I sort of share in those nominations a little bit. It's like, I don't, if the writer wins, I don't get a Nebula or anything, but still, it's like, I'm proud of those, obviously. It'd be nice if somebody let me know that they were, they were nominated before. It's like, you know, like every year, like, well, last year, a writer did let me know, you know, ahead of time, and then it's prompted me to be like, hey, you know, everybody, you know, on Twitter, it's like, you know, if you got nominated, it's okay to tell me. Actually,
You're a trap for all the people who were nominated.
No, I actually emailed all the contributors because in our first year, it was a fairly, I think it was like 16 original stories. So I was like, I only had 16 people to email. I actually emailed them all. I said, hey, you know, if you got nominated for anything, it's okay to tell me because like, it's okay to tell your editor. It's okay to tell your agent, you know, it's okay to tell us these things. We're not like the public. You know, it's just don't make it public. That's all they want. They don't want you to make it public. It's okay to tell your mother. It's okay to tell your father, you know, your sister, whatever, your relatives. Just don't make it public. And so it's okay to tell your editor. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. So, as usual, I interrupted Genevieve. You were talking and Kate Baker called you. You never finished that story.
Oh. When Kate Baker called me, I assumed it was about the group reading. Immediately was like, is this about the group reading? And she goes, no. And then there was a long pause because I couldn't imagine why else she would be calling me. And finally she had to say, it's about the Nebulas? At which point I said, what about them?
Are you going to be attending?
Yeah, I had no idea. Like, it is sad how far it was from my mind. And when she finally told me, I was like, oh.
Well, and plus you published so much short fiction and stuff. I mean, you could have easily just assumed that it was for a piece of short fiction, not necessarily
also
your novel.
Also, never occurred to me in my lifetime. And it was right before BossCon, so then I had to go to BossCon and not tell anyone.
Oh.
I was just saying.
That's
difficult. I was saying
that
at
was
the
rough.
Con that
at least
it's a very mean thing, yeah.
At least she was at BossCon, so once or twice she walked over to me and gave me the eye, and it was like, yes, thank you.
Were you at least allowed to walk around with like a fecal eating grin, saying "I've got a sequel"?
I hope not ever. That sounds terrible.
You would have been within your rights. That's all I can say. Well, at any rate, Genevieve is going to be reading for you shortly, and I think I think we should take a musical break, and I know I could use some liquid and stuff like that. And you all at home who have not called in, I want you to think about why you didn't. And then forget all that and call anyway. So
call us and tell us why you didn't call in earlier.
They will. They will. Just you watch that phone now. It's exactly
well, as long as they donate, it's okay.
Well, yeah. They yeah, but you see, it's two different phone numbers.
Oh.
It's two different phone numbers. It's 212-209-2950. If there is time, we will be taking listener calls. But the time constraints upon us are dependent on the phone calls that we get. Okay, and that is true. That is absolutely true. So let us take a musical break here. This is very confusing. I'm trying to figure out why is it that on these potentiometers here, they have DAW left and DAW right. This is like, you know, this one is Betsy and that one is Peter. I'm not quite sure what DAW is supposed to stand for. But one way or the other, I'm presuming it's this computer here. And on that computer is a piece of music from a band called Steel Ice Ban. And we're going to listen to that, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Ye Fray France. This is, and there's actually a new Steel Ice Ban album, by the way, coming out sometime mid-March. Don't know about it. Waiting for a review copy. But, reading?
Sure.
Okay. Always. Okay. Always. So, let's first reintroduce ourselves and what we are doing here. We are gathered here today to
cause trouble.
Yeah. Because we are WBAI in New York City. Listener sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. This is usually a time when we're not fundraising that Robert Knight would be on, but instead we have been granted a 3-hour slot to talk about the book Edgar Rice Burroughs, stories inspired by the work of Edgar Rice Burroughs, entitled Under the Moons of Mars, The New Adventures of Barsoom, which in Burroughs' lingo is Mars. And this is actually a very, very big event because March 9th is the 100th anniversary of the publication of the book, not the magazine publication, but the book, A Princess of Mars, which began the whole John Carter series, and John Carter being the protagonist. And so there's a movie coming out, and they say 100 years in the making. And that's not wrong. Bob Clampett tried to do a version. There was a time when you're looking at me, Genevieve, like you don't know this.
I don't.
Oh, but you must. You must.
Tell me.
Bob Clampett, the great Bob Clampett of Warner Brothers cartoons and later on Beanie and Cecil and stuff like that. Bob, at a time when Disney was just proving that feature-length animation could work with Snow White, and that Paramount was giving it an attempt with Max Fleischer's Gulliver's Travels, which was not initially financially successful, but got good reviews. And I loved it as a kid. Warner Brothers, or not Warner Brothers, but Bob Clampett of Warner Brothers, working with Edgar Rice Burroughs, made a Thark. He animated. Wait. Which are the Tharks? The creatures, the mounts?
No, the Tharks are the four-armed green Martians.
Oh, so he didn't do a Thark. He did, what?
A thote, maybe?
Yes, a thote. I thought so. Never mind. Sorry.
Oh.
Okay, Freund. You've been pitching. Breathe. Just breathe. 212-209-2950. It was a thote. And he animated a thote. You can go to YouTube and put in John Carter, thote, Bob Clampett, and words like that, and you can see what he did. He did a trailer. There's actually, you can see a whole thing of Clampett at some animation convention explaining and introducing the clips that he did. And actually, there is also footage of John Carter displaying a long sword and various things like, and jumping through the air. So that was the first major attempt, but was stillborn because Warner Brothers was not known for taking financial chances on animation. You know, 6 minutes was the length for Warner Brothers. And then there was some kind of a version in the 1950s that I forget about, and I understand one should be thankful. But that could not have been anywhere near as bad. You take it.
The recent Sci-Fi Channel adaptation starring Antonio Sabato Jr.
And
Tracy
the greatest
Lords.
Of all thespian actresses.
Tracy Lords. Are we gonna do this on the radio?
Do it. I don't know. There might be a word on there you're not allowed to say, but... Oh, no, it's fine.
No, I think we're fine.
Euphemize.
Oh, no, I don't have to. And frankly, I wouldn't, because some art has to stay just as it is. And that is during the scene when the captive Deja Thoris is being transported by the Tharks.
Why
and
is
the
it?
Company of John Carter. And she is angry at John Carter for what she perceives as his betrayal. He attempts to assure her that he means nothing but good and is on her side, at which point she flings something at him, and Tars Tarkas delivers what has to be the greatest line ever filmed, which is, and I quote, and you're going to think I'm making this up, but this is about as accurate as we can get without actually playing the clip. Ha 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 ha, that was her pee bucket. Which,
great television.
And it's actually like there's like this great long pause. Like for some reason, it's like a good
waiting for the laughter to die down.
Yeah, well, it's like a good 15 seconds after she throws the pee on him, and then it's like ha 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 ha. That was her pee bucket. Just had to be said again. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I know. It was good.
I know.
Good.
When I was little, I also liked Pee Bucket and Sherman. 15-second pause. Anyway, no, no, you don't know Peabody and Sherman.
Nope.
Oh, my God.
I feel like I come
old.
On the radio
I'm
so that you can make fun of me.
Rocky and Bullwinkle and Peabody and Sherman?
We have talked before about how I am not the biggest fan of animation. WALL-E is the exception,
that's
not the
right,
rule.
That's right, yeah. Okay, yes. We it's funny because we agree on movies a great amount and even squeamishness about certain kinds of movies. But
yes.
You will discover animation one day, young lady. He said
condescendingly. Someday, yes.
I don't know which day that will be. I think it's next Thursday, and then
next
after
Thursday
that,
sounds good.
You're going back.
That day will be when one of her stories is turned into an animated feature.
Oh, gosh.
No, a good one. A good animated feature.
Studio Ghibli, or however you say that.
Oh, no. No.
No.
No?
No, I don't think they even did. Yeah, well, you see, that's where, this is another show. I'm not an anime fan.
Mm-hmm.
I love animation, and I say that's why I don't love anime, even Miyazaki. Although I have to give Ghibli another chance. I've watched a portion of Arrietty, and I love the Borrowers. I liked the Chris Eccleston version that they had on the BBC last Christmas. Mm-hmm. It was actually not bad at all. But when I see that they don't do the tweening, now I understood tweening is when you have a movement and then another extreme movement, and tweening are the movements in between so that a movement is fluid. The master animator does the extremes, and then a tweener does the parts in between. And it's not a financial reason, because Arrietty is a high-budget film and, you know, Spirited Away and all of these are very high-budgeted films, but it is a style. It is an issue of the style of anime that they don't do the tweening. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. I can't tell what the difference is from when they do or don't. It seems to be simply, we'll do it now because I'm tired and we won't do it because I'm not tired and we, whatever. Arrietty does not have the tweening in it, and it's very difficult for me to watch, although it looks very faithful. I will watch it. I have a screener. I will watch it. I actually have a screener of the British version, not the American version that just came out.
The British version has great voices.
Yeah. As far as I could tell, the British version looks way cooler. So I'm going to watch that all the way through. But what little I have seen of it, I said, I don't care for anime, because I do love full animation. So, you know, and even when it comes to good science fiction, there's no, I mean, Studio Ghibli did Earthsea.
Sci-fi also did Earthsea.
And theirs was worse. But turning Earthsea over to Studio Ghibli did not make it good.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. It's on Netflix. Or whatever.
Whatever
source. It's on DVD. Okay. It can be seen. I didn't care for it. And it certainly didn't make an impression. Howl's Moving Castle didn't do it for me. I love the book. Ooh. We moved a book. Somebody got a book. Thank you. Tally lag. Enough of my fiddle faddle. How do we even get into that whole thing anyway? I don't know. Let
bygones be bygones.
Indeed. Genevieve is. We were reintroducing the show. My name's Jim Freund. This would be the beginning of Hour of the Wolf if it were on. I won't be on next week, by the way, not because of the fundraising drive, but because every March 8th we take out for the celebration of International Working Women's Day, which is an ultra cool thing. So, but it just worked out for me. I got so annoyed that I wouldn't be on, therefore, from January until the Ides of March. I'll be back March 15th. I think with Terry Bisson, but I've also got coming up in March Rudy Rucker and a couple of other fairly interesting people. Oh, Saladin. No, not Saladin. He owes me a recording. No, Eugene Myers. E.C. Myers.
Nice.
Whose first novel, Fair Coin, is coming out. One thing before you begin reading. Okay, with me, I'm Jim Freund, by the way, with me are John Joseph Adams, editor of the book Under the Moons of Mars, and also editor of the webzine LightspeedMagazine.com, just called Lightspeed for short, and producer and co-host of Geek's Guide to the Galaxy at Wired.com. And Genevieve Valentine, cool person, Nebula Award-nominated novelist. That sounds so cool to say. And a great short story writer. I think the first time you were on the air, John brought you and you read a book from... No, it wasn't the first time you were on.
It was. I read my story from Federations.
From Federations,
yeah. And apparently she passed out right beforehand.
I did. I asked for a musical interlude because paralyzing stage fright, and I went out in the hallway and I blacked out.
Yes. And now you know, oh, it's Freund. So... Like,
she's come a long way since then.
Yeah, really.
Baby steps.
Again, squeaky hammers. But anyway, so that is who is here, and Genevieve is about to read for us a story out of this book. But first, with me, there's always a but first, as it were. I enter the room, but first. But first, sorry, hyper. I'm really hyper. Next Tuesday, 7 o'clock, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings presents, by coincidence, readings from Under the Moons of Mars. And on the panels around us, we will have drawings from the book, maybe a poster from the movie. I have some other ideas for some of the screens that I want to talk to you about. And we will have a very, very, very special thing. I talked to John about, you know, let's let people know what this John Carter stuff is anyway. And we went back and forth. He had these really cool ideas on who could do an introduction. I thought we could film something. And John came up with this webpage, actually, at SF Signal, edited by John DiNardo, where this fellow, Larry, whose last name, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, and besides, the byline on the webpage is just Larry. Mm-hmm. Larry did this really, really good page telling us all about John Carter. So we asked him, would you do a video of this? And he came back with something that is just really fun and cool. And John and I had a couple of recommendations, which he came up with, you know, and took to heart. And I think we've got him hooked, by the way. I think that he's going to do several of these now. We may have created a YouTube monster.
Oh, great.
I certainly hope so. So if you, so we will have that at the reading next week, and two fly-by-night readers, Kat Valenti, who reads for us like every year and a half, and that's almost not often enough. We have to get Genevieve back in there.
Really also soon. This year Nebula nominee, Kat Valenti.
Right. And Jonathan Mayberry, which will be a first for us to have him read there. And I met him last year at BEA. He's just a really nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy who, you know, says, you know, writes an email that says hello, and it becomes a New York Times bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, I don't know how this happens, but he's got the touch. And it's good reading, too. And he's got a really fun story in the book. So he and Kat will be reading, and Genevieve will be there to accept your obeisance and stuff like that. No. We'll have other writers from the anthology present. Leave it at that. And you can bring... Well, you won't have the WBAI. Well, the BAI copies of the book are already somewhat autographed if you call now. So that's next Tuesday. Doors open at 6:30. Come there, or else you'll miss out on the cider and cheese. I get very Monterey Jack and cider and Red Jack and cider. Very good stuff. all free. We ask for a donation so we can buy dinner for the readers afterward. And I think we'll buy drinks for all the contributors to the anthology. Can't do dinner for all the contributors, but we'll buy drinks for them. So, you know, that should be encouraging. And 138 Sullivan Street, between Houston and the street formerly known as Prince. And for more information, you can go to ourwolf.com, ourwolf.com/NYRSF, Nyrsif, and click on the link there that says more details, and you'll get the full press release and all the information. Or if you're on Facebook, I know very few people are, but if you're on Facebook, there is now a New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group that you can join and get mailings from. And there is now, as of a few hours ago, an Hour of the Wolf group, which actually has been there for a long time, but it was closed and I've opened it and I don't know if I'll do anything with it. But go and join the groups. Why not? Okay. No more but firsts. Somebody, maybe John, you should be hosting at this point and saying, okay, Jim, you can now pitch. And now, Genevieve, really. John, say, Genevieve, you read now.
Genevieve, read now.
That was a very pea bucket of you.
Ha 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 ha. Read now.
I cannot refuse such an awesome offer. I'm going to give a little background for those who are not quite up to date on their Barsoom, because very quickly Barsoom spirals out into a very dynasty sort of soap opera thing that includes 800 characters. And when John contacted me, he said that I could write about any of the characters who took my fancy. And I read the first three books, and the one that caught my imagination the most was The Chessmen of Mars, which focused on the daughter of John Carter and Dejah Thoris, whose name is Tara. And at the beginning of the book, she is something like 14, which is strange because several weeks later she ends up married. No one ever thinks that that's weird. She is my first 16-year-old protagonist who's already married.
Years work differently on Mars.
Fair enough. And like many Barsoomian ladies, she is apparently super well-trained and the finest, fiercest warrior, except that what happens to her is she's kidnapped and she cries a lot until someone saves her. And she manages to do pretty well for herself in terms of Barsoomian females, manages to befriend a member of her captor's enclave, who gives her enough hints to help her survive the game of Jatan. And Jatan is a version of living chess that is run by the murderous Chaldeans. And they like to staff it with people that they have captured because their city, Manator, is surrounded by horrible storms that crash everybody's flyers, and they just pull people from the wreckage and throw them on the board. And it turns out that through a combination of Burroughs' own imagination and fan participation afterwards, Jatan was fleshed out to the point that it can actually be played. I knew how to do that for about 3 days in the middle. And I really liked the idea of Jatan as it was, and I was very interested in, as we talked about earlier this evening, examining and interrogating what Burroughs had presented, which is someone who is entirely capable of defending herself, but who, as my epigram says, the princess may not move onto a threatened square, nor may she take an opposing piece. And I read that and I was like, we'll see. And so that is where this story came from. What am I missing that we need to back up on? At the very beginning of the book, she is engaged to a man named Jorkantos. Again, 14. engaged to a man named Jorkantos, who she decides in the first 10 pages that she doesn't actually love, and who, by the time she returns from the desert, thinks that she's dead and has engaged himself to someone else. And I was like, that is so awkward. How can you not write about that? The heart of the YA experience is the awkward ex. So, this is A Game of Mars. When Tara stepped from her flyer, she was surprised her brother was not there to greet her. Jorkantos was. Jorkantos, a noble of the city. Jorkantos, who had been her intended husband until the morning a year ago that she discovered he cared for another. That was the morning she'd taken her flyer into a storm and ended up a prisoner of the Caldanes, a living player in a gladiatorial game of Jatan. Much had changed since then. Princess, he greeted. Your mother, Deja Thoris, has bid me make you welcome. It was a formal speech. Too formal for old friends, and he didn't look her quite in the eye. Too much had changed. You're kind, she said. Where is Carthoris? Your brother and his wife should be here shortly, Jor said and frowned. Do you mind my greeting you? No, she said too quickly, and when he held out his hand, she took it without looking him in the eye. Her husband was waiting at home in Gathol. Jorkantos had not been hers for a year, and she had not loved Jorkantos to distraction then. Why was it so hard to meet him now? They walked to the audience hall in a silence that made it hard to breathe. They'd grown up together. He'd been her dance partner, her sparring partner. They had tested their skills against her brother Carthoris, and the ongoing tally of wins had been the biggest argument she and Jorkantos ever had. Both of them hated to lose. How quickly two people can grow to be strangers, she thought. Then they were at the door, and Tara was face to face with her mother. Greetings, Deja Thoris, said Tara in the formal manner. But a moment later, Tara was caught in an embrace, their arm bangles clanging, as her mother said, How I've been expecting you! Tara grinned. I still have a whole speech our advisors wrote for me, a list of your best qualities. Apparently that's very good for trade. Should I recite it now or wait for Carthoris? Deja Thoris laughed, and Tara even caught the ghost of a smile on the face of Jorkantos. Then a messenger burst into the hall. He was followed by two sword-wielding guards, but the messenger looked so terrified that Tara knew it couldn't just be the guards that worried him. Something else, something worse, was wrong. As soon as the messenger saw them, he cried, I request the audience of Deja Thoris! You have it, she said. Speak. He fell to one knee, his eyes fixed on the floor. Princess, the messenger gasped, your son's ship has been destroyed in the Bantum Desert outside Manator. Tara went cold. Manator was the city of the Caldanes. But even as Deja Thoris gripped the arms of her throne in terror and demanded the messenger explain, Tara knew what the messenger would tell them next. There were no bodies. Caldanes took their captives alive and saved them for the game. Jorkantos was standing at her mother's side, asking the messenger for information he wouldn't have, and Tara felt as though it was all at a great distance, as if that horrific city was already dragging her back across the burning sand. For my brother's sake, she thought, her heart pounding. My brother. Without thinking, Tara was running for the armory, then for her flyer, her favorite short sword in her hand. It was a shame, she thought, to leave Helium again so soon. Gathol was still not her city, and she had been so looking forward to coming home again. But she had no choice. By the time her mother had spoken to her advisors, had made plans, had dispatched soldiers enough to overpower the Caldanes, Carthoris and Thuvia would be dead. In Manator, Jatan was played to the death, and Caldanes did not delay their pleasures. They would be pulled onto the board before they had time to strategize, because a hasty game meant better fighting. Tara had survived the game as a princess, forbidden to fight, fought over. But she had watched and learned. Now it was time to show what sort of pupil she was. To go alone might well be suicide, but there was no time to wait. There was no time. Her flyer was standing open on the landing pad, and she was already in the cockpit when she heard echoing footfalls from the palace. Where are you going? Jor shouted. She said, To Manator. Tara expected him to tell her how her mother needed her, or that she had other considerations that should keep her home, or that there was nothing she could do. But he only glanced back at the palace and squared his jaw as if he was deciding something. Then I go too, he said, turning back to her. She bristled. She had been very headstrong about small things not long ago. But there was not enough time left, not even to be proud. Come on then, she said, starting the engine, and close the door behind you. We have to reach the Bantum Desert before dark or we'll be too late. For what? She smiled, all teeth. For the game. Tara knew better this time how to navigate the ravine and the vicious storm between Helium and Manator, though the winds battered them until her hands were white-knuckled on the controls. Behind her, Jor braced himself as best he could. Her flyer was meant only for one, and he spent the journey kneeling beside her with one hand on her chair for balance, like a sprinter about to hear the starting horn. She was almost glad for the storm, as it kept her from wondering why he had come with her. He was as loyal to Carthoris as she was. It didn't need to be more than that. Aid was aid. Whenever she dared take a breath, she tried to explain what he could expect once they were inside the walls. She described the Caldeans. Parasites, jarred brains that used tentacles to attach themselves to senseless, headless bodies, as most Barsoomians put on and discarded cloaks. And he gripped the chair until his fingers shook. "They're ruthless and cruel," she said. "Though one of them, Gek, was kind to me when I was imprisoned." "Not kind enough to free you," Jor said. But Tara knew some things were out of a soldier's power, and she said, "He helped me prepare for Jatan, and I will always be grateful." After they were safely around the next bend, he ventured, "Tell me the game. I haven't seen it since I was a boy. I remember orange and black squares and the chief and the princess on each side, and that each side had two flyer-shaped pieces that didn't look anything like flyers I'd seen." "Flyers aren't on the living board," she said. "Bad luck for our escape. It's just two more terrified men fighting for their lives in the arena." He glanced at her, didn't answer. She explained the rules of Jatan. Panthan mercenary pieces that formed the first expendable line of defense. Staid captains and lieutenants who moved in only one direction. Warriors who had more flexible paths. Thote-mounted fighters who could jump intervening pieces. "We won't know what to expect until they're already on the board," said Tara. "Often a chief can choose his own pieces, but sometimes the Caldeans assign them from within the prisons." "Is that where your brother will be?" "Thuvia will be kept in a tower," she said. "Carthoris underground. It's a maze of cells. There won't be time to look there. We'll have to wait until they're on the board before we strike, and hope Carthoris is chief. He won't be in danger right away, and we'll have some time."
"And Thuvia?"
"Thuvia will be safe until after the game," Tara said. Jor raised his eyebrows. "But this game is played to the death. How can you know?" "The princess does not fight," said Tara. "She's preserved as a prize for the Caldean that wins." He frowned. Then after a moment he said, "I'm sorry for what you've seen." "Don't be," she said. "What I've seen might save their lives." Still, it was good to hear. It gave her an idea why he had been so uneasy around her this last year, and why he had insisted on sharing this danger now. After that, there was a companionable silence, the most comfortable she'd felt with him since the morning she'd realized he loved someone else. It felt familiar, and it steadied her for the fight ahead. Her course was bold, and her piloting sure, and she made it nearly to the Bantum Desert in one piece. Then the clouds thickened, and she overcorrected, and the edge of one wing caught the wall of the ravine. It was barely a scrape. On a calm morning, she would have righted and not given it a thought until she landed back home. But in winds as tangled as these, deep in shadows not even the moons could reach, it was a death sentence. The flyer ricocheted off the ravine and broadsided the opposing wall of stone. Tara and Jor were thrown against the ceiling amid a cracking and crunching Tara prayed was not bone. The flyer careened out of control, and with her last moments, Tara thought, "If we must die, may this flyer kill even one Caldean when it lands." Then there was a sharp fall, and darkness claimed her. When Tara woke, it was to pain, and a sandy, claustrophobic darkness that nearly drove her to panic. But she steadied herself, and after a few breaths she realized the crash had driven her underneath one of the consoles of her flyer. She remembered her brother's danger, and Jor, and their ruined flight. But if they had crashed, how was she not already in the towers of Manator? Had they been hidden from view? Were they miraculously safe? No knowing and hiding. Tara steeled her nerves, untangled herself from the mess of wires, and crawled out into the cabin of the flyer. The first thing she saw was the dawn light glinting through the windshield. At least this was not a tomb. The second thing was that Jor was gone. It wasn't a mystery that took long to solve. The entry hatch of the ship was standing open, and the floor bore the marks of someone being dragged out fighting. Jor had been taken by the Caldeans, and they hadn't looked for others because her flyer only sat one. Poor Jor Kantos, she thought, to have come so far and be taken this way. But not for nothing. If she could fight for two, she could fight for three. She wrenched her hair into a knot, tightened her scabbard, and climbed out of her ship. The city of Manator rose from the sand at the edge of the horizon, jagged and hopeless behind its walls. The sun was just rising over the lower buildings. The high towers and the flyer landing pad were thrown into silhouette, long shadows that warned her back where she had come. Too late for that, she thought with a shudder, and started walking. By the time she reached the gate of Manator, it was morning, and she was almost out of time. A guard, bemused, asked her name and business. Thora, she lied. I'm a Panthen. I'm here to play Jatan. The guard said, You seem a bit young to be throwing your life away, but who can understand the decisions of the lesser-minded? And inside the glass, his brain swiveled to indicate where she should go for her work. She found she could walk alone through the streets, and though there was no time to waste, there was still enough time for her to note the streets and alleyways, and to see that the flyer platforms were guarded by only a few Caldanes who seemed more interested in watching the streets below than in guarding their charges. She prayed the novelty of the crowd would not have worn off by the time she came back this way. If she came back this way. She'd seen Jatan before. It was not a game with many survivors. It was enough of a novelty for a young woman to play the game that the two competing Caldanes, whose names slimed past her in a single guttural laugh, offered her a choice of teams. Come, said one, and the arm of the headless body was held out to her in the mockery of a gentleman. They're taking the field. She stood in the gateway at the edge of the arena, watching black-armored Panthens and Thotes take their places along the first line, as the orange side did the same in the marked-out squares on their side of the arena. Tara held her breath until she saw a tall, confident figure she recognized instantly, even from so far away. "The Black Army," she said. The two Caldanes immediately launched into a fight with each other over her choice. A guard ran to stand between them and forced them to their separate sides. Tara paused a moment in the gateway, glanced at the wall beside her, and let something fall. Then she was running across the arena as fast as her feet could carry her. She didn't call her brother's name, he was too clever to use his own. But still he turned and saw her before she would have thought possible, and for a moment his entire face was suffused with joy. It wouldn't last. There was too much danger for joy to last, but she understood. She smiled even as she ran. When she skidded to a stop, she didn't dare reach for him, and he crossed his arms as if trying to keep himself from embracing her. I should have known, he said finally. You always did love games you knew you could win. Let's hope that holds for your sake. Then her smile faded. Make me a warrior. They have the most flexibility, and at the end of the game, you and Thuvia... But here Carthoris's face fell. The Black Princess emerged from the shadows of the holding cell, trying bravely not to cry. She was a stranger. Carthoris, Tara breathed. Where's Thuvia? He didn't answer. In horror, Tara turned to look where the last of the orange pieces were emerging. There was Thuvia in an orange robe, taking her place as the prize. Beside her, the chief of the orange pieces was already in place, staring at them, horrified. It was Jorkantos. Tara held her breath. Her fingertips went numb. Then a voice cried, Let the game begin! The game was well matched, too well matched, and each side lost Panthens at a staggering rate until only the trickier pieces remained. Tara did not notice this, though she should have. She was thinking only of the gate. The gate had but one guard, and he had not yet noticed that she had dropped one of her thick golden bangles to keep the ground bolt from sliding home. That was their escape. Her brother already knew her plan, whispered in the moments before the pieces were ordered to take their places, and as soon as Thuvia and Jdor came within hearing, she'd make good on their escape. With all four of them armed, it would be easy enough to overpower the guards and steal a flyer home. All the while her stomach was churning as she snuck glances at Thuvia and Jor across the board, waiting for their turn to be played. However, when Tara saw that all the spaces to her right had emptied, she realized how clever the Caldane controlling the Black Team must be. He'd sacrificed so many Panthens to give his stronger pieces room to cross the board. The Thote before her marched to battle, and she watched the last orange Panthen die under its feet. Then her square was being called. With a glance at her brother, his hands fisted at his sides and his eyes fixed on her, she advanced. The flyer who slid forward gave her a pitying smile. She saw his hands shaking. He knew this game was his last.
Be brave, he said, as if to himself. Die with honor, she said. A few moves later, he did. And Tara stood in the square beside his body, breathing heavily and looking at the board ahead. The Khaldane playing orange must have been angry with her for throwing his expectations. The next thing he moved was a thoat, pawing at the ground and straying against the reins of its rider. It had been inching toward one of their flyers, but apparently the Khaldane had lost his patience, and its course was now fixed on her. A screech of laughter floated through the crowd as the black-sided Khaldane ordered her to take the square. Tara trembled and stepped forward. She remembered sparring with Carthoris and Jor when they could still barely lift their swords. "Watch here," said her brother to Jor, brushing his hand along the back of Tara's arm. "It cannot be defended and incapacitates. Every creature has these. Find them and use them." The soft spot of a thoat is just below the front legs, in the space usually protected by the elbow. When the thoat crashed to the sand, it trapped the rider waist-high beneath it. He struggled to reach his weapon, but it was pinned beneath the beast. He looked up at Tara in terror. Tara lifted her sword and hesitated. She stepped back, called, "I will not kill him." There was a murmur from the stands, and a moment later two of the slave masters were flanking the board. "I'm a volunteer," she told them. "You have no power here. I cry mercy for this man. The game master decides." Softly from behind her, she heard her brother whisper, "Careful." But she offered them neither abuse nor apologies, and after a moment they got some signal and moved to remove the thoat and walk the warrior off the board. He cast a grateful glance over his shoulder, and she nodded back. She was still focused on the victory, and it took her a moment to realize how much closer she had moved to the ranks of the Orange. Thuvia was looking across the board at her husband, shaking her head in terror. Jorkantos was looking straight at Tara with an expression that could cut marble. Then she realized what the Orange Khaldane had had in mind when he'd arranged the move. It was a trap. If she took two more squares, she was going to challenge the chief. The game moved on, but Tara was frozen, staring into the face of an old friend with whom she had just become comfortable again after a painful absence. Jor had looked away and now stood watching the board, frozen with dread. Beside him, Thuvia reached out a sympathetic hand. "The Black Chief is challenged," Tara heard. She turned. Though the first challenge to a chief was usually to test his skill rather than to take the board, she knew this game had gotten ugly when she saw the Orange had sent a dwar, a captain, for the fight. This was for the kill. Tara knew Carthoris would win. The only person who outclassed him with a blade was their father. But she could not think even of his being wounded, and she watched the battle with a sour stomach, fearing at any moment to hear the captain's blade slicing home. When the captain fell to the ground, Tara let out a breath she didn't know she'd been holding, and it was so loud that Carthoris looked up from the body and smiled at her, so quickly no one else could see. Then the game master called, "Warrior challenges chief!" Tara spun to look at Jorkantos, who was moving forward as if his feet were in lead sandals. "No!" cried Carthoris from behind her. But she stepped forward, her sword at the ready. Jor's face was stony, and she wondered if he had been planning some hero's suicide for himself while he'd been waiting. "Not now," she thought. "Don't you dare give up now that we're friends again." He stepped close and raised his sword. Then he murmured, "I hope you have an escape plan, or your brother is going to be very upset with me." Relief flooded her so sharp it was like pain. "He'll be the least of your problems once I'm done with you," she said, and took a fighting stance. Then they began. It looked to the Khaldanes like a battle between two equals of skill. Only Carthoris would know that it was their old dexterity figures which looked dangerous but never struck. It felt for a moment like home. When they were pressed shoulder to shoulder, swords locked, Tara whispered quickly about the gate and the flyer's tower. "When?" he asked, over the clang of metal. Even as he asked it, she realized. "Now," she said. "It has to be now." "All right," Jor said. In the next moment, he'd spun away from her and the sword was flying out of his hand. It struck one of the slave masters and pinned him to the sand like an insect. Beside him, his fellow staggered backward with a squeal. Even before the outcry rose from the Khaldanes in the arena, Tara was running for her brother. "Here," she said, shoving her sword into the hands of the princess. "If you're fighting, fight." The princess blinked but took a grip on the sword that looked passable. Carthoris was shaking his head, but already his sword was in Tara's hands, and they were halfway to the gate. "Those who would be free must fight," Carthoris called. Nearly all the remaining pieces shouldered their weapons and bolted. Ahead of her, Thuvia and Jor were already at the gate, dragging it aside. The guard vanished under George's sword, and Thuvia braced herself on the other side against any oncomers. Beside Tara, Carthoris was keeping pace, and they were nearly at the gate and free. Then she crashed to the ground. There was a searing pain in her right leg, and she knew at once she'd been struck, a knife or a blade disc. Carthoris was already turning back. "No!" she shouted. But because he was her brother, he didn't listen. Because he was her brother, he would risk death for her, too. She heard the whistling of other blades as they seemed to bloom from the sand, and she knew that before he could get hold of her, he'd be struck. Then from behind her, she heard the clang of metal against metal. The thoat rider she had spared was standing over her. "They'll be sending soldiers soon," he said, without taking his eyes off the edge of the arena. "Go!" Carthoris hauled her up by the ribs, and the two of them staggered together for the safety of the gate. "Are they safe?" Tara gasped between breaths. "They've made it out of the gateway, at least," Carthoris said. "If you hurry, we might not even die." Tara could have hit him. Instead, she ran faster. Behind them came the cry of a wounded man. "Die with honor," Tara thought, with a pang of loss that was worse than the wound. But her legs had not given out on her entirely. She ran with one blood-slicked foot, and then ahead of them was the gate and the tunnel to the street, and then, if they lived, the flyer's home. The streets were full of panic, but not of swords, and they made good time, Tara slipping once or twice as her bloody heels skidded on the pavement. By the time they reached the flyer platform, the battle was struck in earnest. The Chaldeans had sent troops to reinforce the platform. Thuvia was farthest ahead, darting toward one of the flyers. The Chitan men in black and orange had fallen back and were fighting side by side against the monstrous bodies of Chaldean troops. And from the side of the platform that was flush against the city, reinforcements were already coming. Jor had hung back, and when he saw them coming, he reached for Tara to help ease her brother's burden. "Help Thuvia!" Jor called, and Carthoris disappeared into the melee. Jor surveyed the oncoming soldiers. "This'll be an ugly fight," he said. Tara grimaced. "Then put me somewhere and give me a sword." "I'll put you at my back," he said, "and we'll see if we can take some of the fight out of them." A short sword appeared in her hand, and she braced herself as best she could. "And if we die today," said Jor, "know that it did me good to be your friend again." Tara could think of nothing to say. She couldn't say "die with honor," not to him. And instead she only raised her sword and prepared to fight. One of the Chaldeans caught sight of her and began the charge along the edges of the platform, skirting the battle to reach her faster. "Warrior challenges the chief," she thought. Then there was the roar of engines and the screams of the Chaldeans from below, and Tara looked up and saw a flyer descending, bearing the crest of Dejah Thoris, come to take them home. As soon as Tara was home and out from under the doctor's stitches, she sent for her husband, Gahan. "Tell him nothing of what has happened," she told the messenger. "Let it wait until I can tell it." That night she lay on a chaise in her quarters with Carthoris and Thuvia and Jor beside her. Jor was his old self, open and easy, and Carthoris as he always was, and Tara thought it would have been worth the danger just to have Jor as her friend again. To have a brother back was something that needed no words. "The Chaldeans have blades either rusted or poisoned," said Tara. "My whole leg burned when it struck me." "Their blades might be trying harder to kill you," Carthoris pointed out. "You've triumphed over them so many times it's made them angry." "I can triumph over you, too," she said. "I'm advised not to stand. That doesn't mean I can't fight." A messenger interrupted. Gahan had arrived. Thuvia smiled and stood. "I'll greet him," she said. "Don't test yourself. Your will is greater than your need." "It would never be the reverse," Carthoris said, and Jor nodded once in agreement. Tara had no ready answer for the praise of a brother and a near brother. Beside them, the sun was setting, and the warm light of the Barsoom sun bathed the room around them in just the way she'd grown up with. Though she'd have to leave Helium soon and return to her husband's city, this was the way she would always consider light to be most beautiful. Some things, maybe, did not have to change after all. "Tara," Carthoris cut in, "is everything all right? How do you feel?" She smiled and said, "At home."
You've been listening to A Game of Mars, read for you by the author, Genevieve Valentine, from the anthology, Under the Moons of Mars. This is Kate Rusby.
When tonight I feel some drops of rain, I never had
this light. I'll do so much for my true love as any young girl may. I'll sit and mourn on your grave for 12 months and a day.
Wonderful Kate Rusby with her song The Unquiet Grave. I was going to play this 1912 medley of songs about games, but Ring Around the Rosie, just as Genevieve said, wouldn't have been the appropriate death chant, really. And I refuse to play anything that involves Klingons, so... And there just isn't a whole lot of Barsoomian music out there. John was talking about folk metal off the air. And that now, you see, that would have actually sort of followed, wouldn't it, if you think about it?
Mm. Barsoom is pretty metal.
Yeah, it is. It is. Pull the mic closer to you.
Oh, but yeah, sorry.
No, it's okay for you to sit back. Yeah. Just bring the mic back to where you are. Bring the mic to you. Genevieve, that was great.
Thank you.
Yeah. For the record, by the way, I timed one page at random. It was 2:25. So my count of a page being somewhere between 2 minutes, 15 seconds and 2.5 minutes, we were talking about this, trying to get two stories in the show. And John said that, oh, help me.
Robert Sawyer?
Rob Sawyer.
Yeah.
Had a graph, mm-hmm. which of course goes, as most writers would think, by word counts. Mm. I am not a writer. I pick up a book, I start reading, and I time it, and I know how long it should be. And lo and behold, they coincided.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were both within like 5 to 10 seconds of each other. But I also knew I was right because when Mary Robinette Kowal and I did a thing at ReaderCon last year, we had a similar kind of thing where it turned out we looked at each other and said, yeah, that's right. And just to let you know, that was
spot on.
Spot on. Absolutely. Yes. And if it wasn't, then I have to adjust my reading speed because that was a lovely reading.
Thank you.
Thank you. And a cool story, too.
Thank you.
So this is WBAI in New York City, allegedly listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is a special edition of Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Hour of the Wolf will return to these airwaves, I trust, upon the Ides of March, that is to say, in 2 weeks. I know today is now March 1st. But there are probably still listeners in California, I hope Christy is listening, for whom it is still Leap Day. So this is our Leap Day program, but we're going to try to stay on mic regardless of its being Leap Day. And we are gathered to try to have fun, talk about the anthology Under the Moons of Mars, edited by the aforementioned John Joseph Adams. And you just heard a story from that collection by Genevieve Valentine. And at the same time, raise money for WBAI, for listener-sponsored radio, and to nitpick, to get it down, to narrowcast it to a point, to have you, the listeners, say to the station, I like being read to by writers. I like having this kind of thing on the radio. I don't get enough of this. I want to hear more of this, and darn it, I'm willing to send a signal all the way up to Phobos and Deimos in order to tell people that this is what I want. And the way you do that is by making a phone call. 212-209-2950. If you pledge $75 in as a gift, as a thank you gift for that pledge, we will gift you in return a copy of Under the Moons of Mars. And I know that we still have enough left that yours will probably be autographed by Genevieve and John. So do it today. Do it now. Afterward, it can be done through other means, and the price, the pledge, level pledge that you have to give in order to get a copy of this through our website will go up. I see one person is calling right now. Thank you very much. If we could get a couple of more calls, I would be very, very pleased, and so will you, because it will pay you back with more good radio, and you'll get a very cool book. And if you come to the reading from this collection next Tuesday at 138 Sullivan Street, well, you will be thanked there. Okay, why is somebody calling the control room on a line that they know is audible? Yo. Hi there, Robert. Oh. Okay. Thank you, Robert Nye, but why don't you call on a number where I can put you on the air? Say again? I'm here. Okay, I'll check my email. Should I hang up? Okay, thank you. Okay, I'll see you soon, I hope. Okay, that was Robert Knight, whose time slot this is also, because we were going to share it, and we are going to share it, I think, in a few weeks. But he told me to check my email. So let me do that right now, actually. Rather than using the computer, let me use the my little Phobos phone here. That would actually...
We'll all check email. If you're listening at home, check your email.
Check your email and pledge. And what I think that part of what Robert is saying is that people should pledge because this is also his show. And he does stuff on his show that is just simpatico and way cool and stuff like that there. No, okay, it has not yet gotten to me. That's because I'm bouncing it. So give me a moment. I actually have to do this through the computer in order to make it work. But again, let me just say, 212-209-2950. Robert says that he came to this radio station first, somewhere in the 70s, in order to get a premium that I was offering on the air. It was a Warp poster. If anybody knows of the Broadway show Warp, written by Neil Adams, written and designed by Neil Adams, a great comic book artist, we had these subway-sized autographed posters that Neil gave us to give away on the air. And that was Robert's first premium. And so I'd done a good deed there. So let me see. Okay, I've got to log in order to make this work, don't I? Okay, yes. They're getting, yeah. Sign in here, sign in there. Yes, yes, I have no privacy, and I must sign in. 212-209-2950. And right after I finish doing this, I would like to hear about, what is it called?
Boy.
Boy, oh boy. So, and I also want you, all you listeners out there, to send me email that I will forward to say, Jim, what this show needs is a movie critic. And by the way, it doesn't have to be genre, in case you haven't figured that out. You know, that's it. And doesn't even have to be strictly movies. In other words, you get a segment. You are the producer. I'm the executive producer, but it's your call. Because I got an email saying, well, but Jim, it isn't this or that. And it's like, yeah, okay. That's fine. That's cool. I do any number of shows in this time slot that aren't necessarily about science fiction, fantasy, and all that, and it's not required.
Then I will get a car phone and a convertible and produce all kinds of movies.
Okay, that is well, what will happen. Well, that is way cool, but I'll help. I will help facilitate your recording capabilities.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. So let me see. Okay, I'm seeing. Okay. Oh, I got. Okay, Robert, I have not seen an email from you here yet. So maybe, Robert, if you were to call on a phone number where I could put you on the air, then I would know what it is you have to say. I have emails from other WBAI people and then some, because Margot isn't strictly... Well, she's still a WBAI person, Margot Adler. But... And one from Dave Kenny about his show this week, but nothing yet from Robert Knight. Aha, okay, he's calling on that line. Yo. Yes, Robert. No, that won't work. Just make it Jim. Jim at ourwolf.com. No Freund necessary. Yeah. Okay. Resending. Way cool. So, let us see. So we have, why don't you talk about Boy now, and then after that, I will get to Robert's email.
I would love that. Recently, I had the opportunity to attend a screening of a movie called Boy, written and co-starring a gentleman whose name I have not had a chance to hear pronounced before this, so apologies if I mangle it, Taika Waititi. He is a Maori gentleman who has done a lot of comedy writing and apparently worked on Flight of the Conchords, which is pretty cool. And he did this really great tragicomic coming-of-age movie that somehow managed to... It manages to occupy sort of a liminal space where it's not quite a fantasy movie, but there are definitely aspects of it where the imagination is portrayed in ways that one would not expect. The hero of the movie is Boy, who is a young gentleman of about 11 or 12, played amazingly by James Rolston. Like, just an incredibly subtle, soulful performance. Really great stuff. It grounds the movie. And he does a direct address in the first few minutes, so you get the whole cast of characters. He's living in a small town with his grandmother and his younger brother, who believes that he has magical powers that are detailed in the sketches that a six-year-old would make. So he keeps hoping that maybe he can tip the school bus into the ocean and you see a tiny little school bus online paper vanish. Their father has been absentee for a large portion of their lives, but during a week where their grandmother has gone to a funeral and Boy is taking care of the household full of young cousins, their father comes home, ostensibly to bond with the children, but also he immediately starts digging for some money that he buried once when the cops were after him. And the father... you know how it is. And the father almost reluctantly starts bonding with his kid by accident. Some of it is funny. Boy has an obsession with Michael Jackson and tends to lionize his father. So his father is a samurai and a diver and a secret agent and also Michael Jackson. And of course, what his father actually is a slightly washed out gentleman who is a leader of a 3-person gang that does nothing. And still has big dreams, calls himself Shogun. The way it falls out is...
Yes.
Realistic. Not always understated, but always realistic. There are some truly cringeworthy scenes where Boy is taking some cues on masculinity from his father, which, mistake. Where everyone in my screening had, like, just covered their faces because it was something that you could see happening, but you'd never wanted to see happening. The only other all Maori movie that I have seen is Whale Rider, which I loved, but it was definitely a more fantastic, much more dramatic look at Maori communities, the characters within it. This was a much more... I don't want to say comic take, but it was definitely a movie that was like, life's funny, ain't it? And I really enjoyed the fact that some things were tied up, some were not. I loved all of the intercuts. And really, James Rolston just nailed it. And from the press materials, I was not surprised to learn that much of the material was autobiographical. I was surprised to learn that James Rolston was apparently cast less than a week before they started shooting. And you really could have fooled me. I hope to see a lot more from him, and I hope to see a lot from Taika Waititi. I think that the movie is definitely something that you should put on your slate. Thank you for nodding, John. I appreciate that.
Yeah, we were all hearing that. I never did see Whale Rider. I always wanted to.
I love that movie.
Yeah, everything that I've
unabashedly.
Heard, everything I've heard about it tells me I will too. And I don't know why it was on my list for a long time, but I have so many things on my list. There was a point when it just sort of fell off just because I never got around to it.
I have followed the career of Keisha Castle Hughes since then, through everything she's ever done, including the movie about the Nativity. I know. However, Oscar Isaacs was in that movie, and then he went on to be in Drive, and he did a fantastic job there. In fact, he does a fantastic job in everything. Good story.
Yeah, okay. I appreciate that. So, now, where's that playing, by the way?
It opens March 2nd. I believe that it is at the IFC Center, but I would have to check because, of course, I did not bring the press materials with me.
Yeah, the thing that was taking up the IFC Center, aside from Pina or Pina, I'm not sure how the choreographer's name was announced. I went to see the Academy shorts, the Academy Award-nominated shorts. And I called it on the animated one, by the way. And you say you don't like animation that much, Genevieve. I challenge you, and you can get this on YouTube, the Flying Fantastic Books of Mr. Morris Lesmore, which in fact won. There was another one, a Canadian one, the title of which I don't recall, but people can look up which were the nominees. That was just phenomenal. They were all decent. Very weird. The weakest of the five was the five nominees. They showed actually about 15. But of the five nominees, was the weakest was a Pixar one, which is very unusual for theirs not to surpass all the others. Perfectly good. But if you're a book lover, and for that matter, if you like Buster Keaton, yes.
Done.
Yeah. Yeah, you're there. And done. It's, you know, it's one, and it's one of the few movies that's probably good on a small screen. But animation, for some reason, often works well on the small screen. Oh, and Robert, I finally got his email. Thank you, Robert. And Robert Knight said, Jim, listening, loving the brilliant guests and looking forward. You understand the radio I love. Well done. And then I am the 3.24 times 12 to the 7th percent. So that's it. And since midnight, we have been here occupying WBAI and as well as Earthwatch. And Robert is, of course, when he's not doing Earthwatch, also, it's not like he's not on the air. He's extremely busy producing 5 o'clock Shadow at 5 o'clock. That's PM on a daily basis. And so the thon is in some way he works harder and yet a break for him. So thank you, Robert. And I do look forward to doing a show with you about some of the weirder and darker implications of especially the young reading science fiction and fantasy. And for that matter, any books of the past that have a certain meaning and impact, the whole Mark Twain question and all of that stuff. It's fascinating stuff and will make a fascinating show because he and I had a long conversation about why he didn't feel comfortable promoting Barsoomian materials until he really reexamined it after having really enjoyed it from his childhood, and is this something to be promoted today for a multicultural society? And I say it is, as long as it is done at least with the manner that John Joseph Adams, as an editor, has steered writers like Genevieve Valentine. And I mean, it's an amazing outline, as most of JJA's anthologies are. I mean, I love theme anthologies. I live for them. I mean, ever since I took over the show from Margot Adler in 1974, what kept me going was that I said, what will I talk about today? Unicorns. Oh, Jack Dan has a collection on that. And Gardner Dozois has a collection on wizards. And I could go by theme and just pull out a short story. And they all work on the air so well. So for me, it was like, you know, choosing a song from an album. So that's taken piecemeal. But taken as a whole, it's just like listening to a record album. It's you're getting and at some point, John, we should talk about the mechanics of anthologies. We can do that maybe over the phone sometime when you're back in California, of how do you choose what story goes first and last. We're not going to discuss the slush thing or anything like that, because as well, we've done a number of slush shows with Douglas Cohen and John, and I was a slush pile reader for Galaxy magazine So, you know, that's not proper for a book editor, really, to discuss at this point. That would be very difficult behind your back, though. It's a work of, well, it's a cool thing. And what do you include and not include, and the kinds of things that we'll be doing next Tuesday in this radio show are sort of, I like to think of as the DVD extras for an anthology.
Actually, for additional DVD extras for this anthology and actually all of my anthologies that I've done to date, if you go to my website at johnjosephadams.com, I actually have little mini sites set up for each of my books. And so, like, for this one, you can go actually, if you just go to johnjosephadams.com/Barsoom, you can find interviews with the authors. You can look at all the art in the book. You can there's a few free stories that you can read and some listen to, actually, as well. So, you know, basically the DVD extras on the website. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell people, though, forget it. Just go to johnjosephadams.com because there's the Sherlock Holmes anthology and this one and that one. There are many worlds to explore. So go to that one, and that will be the portal for all things John Joseph Adams. As is, by the way, GenevieveValentine.com.
And I wish I had anything half as cool as the DVD extra of the Thermian audio on Galaxy Quest, but I don't. I do, however, have links to my free short fiction and
movie reviews
under Questionable Taste Theater, which tells you about all you need to know about that.
Yeah. By the way, forward by Tamora Pierce. We didn't mention that. Mm-hmm. She is so way cool. She's guest of honor at Lunacon this year.
Oh.
And she's been on this show, and I've even worked with her husband at Ziff Davis. Mm. It's, also in here are Theodora Goss. It's just Molly Crabapple did just a wonderful, bizarre.
Isn't it creepy?
Illo. Yeah. Mm.
I love it so much.
Yeah, she is quite a character herself. She did an Yersif reading last July.
Huh.
She and Dave Roman did a comic strip reading. It was so underattended. It was a shame. Last July 5th, I think it was a little underpromoted, and some thought that maybe it was the date. I don't think it was the date. I think people are willing to come out on holidays for cool things, especially when it's like Molly Crabapple and all that. She's very popular, but it's a wonderful illustration. Who owns that, John?
I'm sorry.
Who owns the Illo?
Oh,
Molly.
I assume the artists all own them.
They get them back afterward.
Yeah, as far as I know, I actually didn't deal with the artists directly. It was mostly people at Simon & Schuster. And actually, my agent, Joe Monti, he knew –
Joe's your agent.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, he represents Charles –
That's why he said he's coming on Tuesday.
Yes. Yeah, he represents Charles Vess, and then, he knows a lot of the other artists and whatnot. And so he worked with the people at Simon & Schuster to recruit most of them. And, you know, I had some input, but I was actually very largely hands-off with that, just because I knew other people knew better than I did.
Yeah. And Joe also works with Toby Buckell, who's in the book, I noticed, and people like that. And Joe was, of course, the curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings for a couple of years himself, and a very, very effective one, may I add. But this Molly Crabapple thing is I'm holding it up to the microphone for everybody to see. Better idea, get a copy yourself. Mm-hmm. Donate and do it the expensive way. I mean, you could go to a store and get this for $18, but why do that when you can get one for free by donating $75? But that is what it is. I mean, people do this, and they do it for a good reason, because they believe in what it is that they are doing, and even endorsed by Robert Knight, thank you very much, by calling now at 212-209-2950, and you can get a copy, and I can pretty well guarantee from now through the end of the show an autographed copy of Under the Moons of Mars for a $75 pledge to listener-sponsored WBAI, and a sign that artistic radio and speculative fiction radio are things that you want to see continue on these same airwaves. We have raised so far $410, which isn't nothing. But it isn't the heaps, the astronomical figures that Barsoom should bring in. Thank you.
Yep.
Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, John. You haven't mentioned it at all.
Geek's Guide to the Galaxy is a podcast I co-host with David Bar Kirtley. Sadly, he cannot join us today due to the weather, but right now we're on Wired.com.
Used to be on io9. Yes.
Yeah, we were on io9, and then they had some changes there, caused us to lose our position there. But we found a new home at Wired.com, and we're really excited about that.
That's not chicken feed.
Yeah. I mean, actually, being on Wired.com actually gets us even in front of more eyeballs. So
yeah.
And ear holes, I guess. But.
Ew. Yeah. Q-tip time.
Yeah.
Pee bucket.
Yeah. So we just launched over there a couple episodes ago. Our first interview was with William Gibson, and then we interviewed Robin Hobb. And as I was saying, we actually just interviewed Michael Chabon. We're excited to be over there. It's a geek talk show. I mean, much like this one.
Yeah.
We do an interview, and then we spend the first half of the show is an interview. The second half of the show is, basically Dave and I talking about whatever topic.
Discussion
topics. And lately we've been having guest geeks on as well to join us for that second part. If we have somebody who's a particular expert on the topic we want to talk about, we've done 50-something episodes now. And so it's like, after all those episodes, it's like, Dave and I sort of reached the extent of our extreme knowledge on whatever on various topics, and we just talk to each other so much. It just helps to have another third person in there that we can actually bounce ideas off of and whatnot. We brought a little clip. I don't know if we have time to air it at this point, but
we have, if you include the outro. Oh, we got more money. If another 75, thank
Yay.
You. If we, the answer is not really.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, but if you.
But
if you
so, want, but drive people to
yes.
where they can find it.
Yes.
And
if you want to listen to the podcast, you just go to geeksguideshow.com and you'll find links to all of our episodes there. Doesn't matter if you want to get one of the older ones or if you want to get one of the newer ones, that's our homepage where you can find links to all of the episodes directly. And then you can also go to iTunes and just search for Geek's Guide to the Galaxy and you can subscribe to the podcast and get all the episodes there.
So. Yeah, I have to figure out how I'm an anti-Apple software person. It tends to take stuff over. But I've never found anything half as good as iTunes for collecting podcasts. And that's all there is to it. And I say that as a person who doesn't go for that company. But there is almost no alternative. Mm-hmm. So I don't have one. I'd rather do without. I need to find a really good aggregator of podcasts for the short or I may just break down and get a Nano. Because that I'm willing to, that I'm willing to have Apple stuff on. Mm-hmm. And the Nanos are very cool. But I figure I've got my phone. It's an Android phone. And for some funny reason, Android and Apple don't commingle.
I'm sure there must be some sort of Android app that it's like a podcatcher.
There are any number of them. They suck.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah, I mean.
I can do a long review, comparison review.
I bet
I'm
you
just
could.
Trying a new one now, which is purported to be good. But they all suck, including the one from Google, which I'm very surprised at because Google is generally decent. They have one called Listen. I don't. It doesn't – it's push, not pull. I have to go out and say, bring me that episode, and then I can only get, like, the latest episode. You have an iPod or equivalent thereof, and you pick it up, and there it is. It's that convenient. So I have to find – and more importantly, I have to find out a way to distribute. I'm going to start podcasting. I'm going to start editing down the show to take out the copyrighted moments and put the highlights on. The music is all copyrighted.
Understood.
You can stream it, but you can't podcast it.
Understood completely.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't understand, so sometime.
I'm just trying to decide what noise we'll use for redacted. and how far it will go. So it would be like, I really enjoyed movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, the answer is I edit. I will edit. It's currently a 90-minute show. There'll be one-hour podcasts.
That makes sense.
Which means lots of work. One of the joys of coming into WBAI and doing live radio is outside of the knowledge that we bring. You don't have to spend all that time. I mean, I am sure that Robert, when he does 5 o'clock shadow, he is putting in, you know, 8 to 10 hours actively per episode for the 1 hour show, where for Earthwatch, it's a free form kind of a thing. You can just come in and flow, which is the beauty of late night radio in New York. It's a very unique thing, this kind of radio that we do here. It's not even that much on the other Pacifica stations, this kind of free form. WFMU has a little of it. They're not Pacifica, but they understand, they get it, and they do it properly. But really here, this is the place. Do I sound like I'm leading up to a phone number? Oh, my God. I think I am. 212-209-2950 for $75, for a $75 pledge. You will show the WBAI management that this is radio you like. You will tell, you will be telling your friends the same thing if you then tweet about it or something. And also, for a $75 pledge, you will get a copy of Under the Moons of Mars. So, again, last time for this minute, 212-209-2950. So, again, so it's basically, I mean, if, again, one just goes to johnjosephadams.com, there will be a link to the podcast.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a button right on the homepage for the podcast.
So. That's just the easiest thing. Sure. So your homework, listeners, mm-hmm. 3 points. Mm-hmm. GenevieveValentine.com, and you have to learn how to spell Genevieve correctly. GenevieveVIEVE. Valentine as in February 14th. .com and ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, as in the movie Hour of the Wolf, except that I don't have the of the in there. Well, at the time I got the domain, which was about 1991, mm-hmm. So you know, before the web, I've had this domain. It was always 8 characters and then an extension of 3. So Our Wolf. Otherwise, it would have taken
sense.
OurOfTheWolf.com is like some German gaming group. Mm. And the rock band, there's a punk band in Arizona, I think. Metal band that uses something totally different. Anyway, I like the Ingmar Bergman film. Have you ever seen that?
I have.
Yeah, and you didn't like it.
We'll talk off the air.
Oh, okay. No, it's not a great movie. You know, so, I mean, I love the mood of it, and I love the concept.
I agree.
That comes from the movie Hour of the Wolf. But I would not say if you want great Swedish cinema, or any cinema, go see Hour of the Wolf. I'm not saying that. So...
Was Ingmar Bergman the gentleman that had the letter circulated recently where he rejected an Academy Award nomination and asked that they please never bother him with it again?
No. He's dead, among other things.
This was from ages ago.
Oh.
This was, I believe, for Wild Strawberries?
Really?
Yes.
I don't know that story. I mean, maybe it is. I mean, Wild Strawberries is certainly a Bergman film. So... Maybe. I don't know.
It's true until proven otherwise.
Mm-hmm. No. Okay, yeah, well. I mean, yeah, what proves otherwise? Wikipedia? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. So, our Wikipedia's gotten much better. Talk to us. You're both fascinating, intelligent people, and I'm carrying on the conversation here, and we've got like 10 minutes left.
10 minutes?
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, in addition to Under the Moons of Mars here, I actually have another anthology coming out in April, which Genevieve also has a story in. It's called Armored. It's coming out from Bain Books. It's an anthology of powered armor and mecha stories. you know, which is sort of a subject near and dear to my heart. I got into editing through an interest in writing, and the first thing I ever wrote was a really, really terrible power armor story. So it's sort of like my career has been leading up to this, my entire career here. So
I was waiting for a story of you making power armor. I was all set.
Yeah, I haven't quite managed that yet, and I've never actually worn any kind of armor at all. Really, it's kind of sad. I feel like my life is
not
just...
even like chainmail. There's no mithril in your past
no,
at all.
No, I'm very ashamed to admit it, but it's true. I've never worn armor. I met a member of the 501st, Star Wars Battalion, but I have never donned stormtrooper armor or anything of the kind. I really feel like I'm missing out, but I have edited an awesome anthology of power armor stories, I think, anyway. That's coming out in April, and it's got stories by people like Genevieve and lots of other great writers.
We can figure out, by the way, how to do a reading with you not here and still hosting. Ordover, the owner of the gallery, he is just desperate to use his internet video connection there. And it actually can be done with Big Brother JJA looking fondly, we hope, over the writers.
And wearing armor, please.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so
yeah, I've got to order me some of that Master Chief armor. Yeah, I saw some. Did you see the story about the guy who from Halo? did you see the guy that his fiance left him and just sort of dropped him, like, you know, it seemed very coldly, right? And so he took she gave him the ring back and he sold it and he bought a suit of Master Chief armor.
That sounds very healthy.
Yeah, I know.
Nothing
right?
says I've recovered from that breakup like putting on literal armor.
Yeah. He seemed very happy with it though, and it was pretty cool armor, I have to say.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that was the best use of however many thousands of dollars that ring was worth, but.
How else can 3 months' salary last forever?
Exactly.
Master Chief armor.
There you go.
There's your answer. Yeah, exactly.
All I can get online, by the way, is that he was nominated about 12 times.
Really?
Yes, and he got the Irving Thalberg Award for Thalbergist director. And all that.
Then I'm going to investigate that, because I swear that I came across that. But if it is not true, I must educate myself immediately.
I don't know. He won for Virgin Spring Through a Glass Darkly and Fanny and Alexander.
Did he accept in person for those?
I do not know, but he certainly accepted for the Thalberg.
Well, he didn't write a letter about the Thalberg.
Yeah. He was nominated for Wild Strawberries, Through a Glass Darkly, Cries and Whispers. Three nominations for Cries and Whispers. Something called Face to Face, which I've never heard of. Autumn Sonata, and two for Fanny and Alexander, screenplay and director. So I don't know. I'm looking at this very briefly, but I'm just doing a search on Bergman Oscar. That is Ingmar Bergman Academy Award. And there is actually, there's a YouTube of Bergman receiving the Thalberg Award. So I don't know beyond that.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, what you were saying about the award there, like the being for best Thalberg or whatever, that reminded me. So a couple of years ago, there was a new convention and they wanted to have an award, and so they decided to have the Ben Bova Award. And I was like, so what is this award? I was talking to a colleague, and I was like, so what is this award for? And she was like, I think it's for the best Ben Bova or something. It's like, you know, it's for the most Ben Bova-ish book. As far as anyone could tell, that's what it was. And by a strange coincidence, they gave the first Ben Bova Award to Ben Bova. I was like, well, that's just kind of cheating,
yeah,
isn't
it? Yeah, the fix is kind of in on that thing.
Yeah, I don't really get that. It's like, okay. I mean, I guess if you're going to give the best... if you're going to give an award to the best Ben Bova, I guess you might as well give it to Ben Bova, because I mean, if someone's doing Ben Bova better than Ben
Bova,
can
you imagine Ben Bova losing the Ben Bova Award?
How embarrassing would that be?
But if you had the John Adams Award, it could go to a composer.
That's true.
It couldn't go to a founding father.
Yes, exactly.
And it could go to a great anthologist.
Mm-hmm.
So,
or a starship captain.
To be fair, if you want someone to accept in person at your convention, it narrows the range considerably.
Yes.
I would say so.
P.S. I have worn armor. Have we talked about this?
No.
I may or may not have volunteered at a Renaissance fair for 3 weeks during a summer early in my high school experience.
I bet you did.
And they were like, would you like to wear this peasant dress? And I was like, is there some armor?
So like plate mail or... Or, I'm sorry, plate armor? Plate mail.
Wow, look at you. Okay, for someone who doesn't wear it, you're all over it.
Come on now, I play D&D.
All right.
I just said the wrong thing. I said the fake thing that doesn't exist. Plate mail isn't real. It's plate armor. You can have plate and mail.
You can't have plate and mail. I wore just the mail.
Anyway, okay, yes. Okay, so chain mail?
Just chain mail.
Yeah.
And it turns out that's all you need because that stuff weighs like 800 pounds.
Yeah, right.
And it was the summer in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this was a terrible plan. This was the worst volunteering ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at the source material, by the way, for this Bergman story, which I might point out is unsigned. It's a terse letter penned in 1960. I guess he had time after that to possibly rethink. I think that, I can understand that a bit of being peeved that it had not been nominated for Best Film. It was only nominated for Best Screenplay, and it lost to Pillow Talk.
Okay, that stings. That stings.
Yeah, so...
Have you seen Pillow Talk?
No, I don't
know my. What that it's, is. It's Rock Hudson Doris Day.
Oh, okay.
Say No More.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of covers it.
If Cotton Candy was filmed, that's what those movies would have been. And Pillow Talk is the cotton candy. So it's like the blue raspberry cotton candy of this particular brand of film.
Yeah, the citation they give, by the way, is the Criterion Collection, which is a very good source.
Good, okay. So I was not incorrect.
No, you're not incorrect. Fantastic. But I think there's just more to the story after that, since obviously also he was oft nominated and whether or not he accepted in person, I don't know. Sweden and or Brooklyn were a long way. He did a lot of directing at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Well, then I will be looking into this deeper when I get home.
I would be curious. I know Hour of the Wolf was never nominated for any American award, and it's not a strong movie. It is fascinating. You can't fault Max von Sydow for his performance because you never can, or Liv Ullmann.
I would agree with that. Max von Sydow was in a sci-fi movie. Their adaptation of...
The Black Hole? He was in that.
No, it was... Guy. It was The Tale of Siegfried, and they termed it something horrible. And he was the gentleman at the beginning who discovers Siegfried and raises him up.
I did see that. I saw half an hour of that.
Oh, you missed the best part. Whatever half hour you saw, I'm sure you missed the best part.
I saw the opening half hour. And
I actually am glad we talked about Boy, because while I say questionable taste theater, I do occasionally watch good movies and enjoy them. I just happen to have sci-fi on apparently a larger percentage of the time, and I have seen a truly scary amount of those movies.
I call it sci-fi.
Ha ha ha.
Pee bucket. That's going to have to be a call. That's, I think, the official
quality radio.
the official word of the morning outside of the phone number. And by the way, we have 30 seconds left. Yes, because we have to play an outro.
30 seconds.
30 seconds.
It's been real.
Say something funny. Quick.
Okay, no, you talk. I'll find the theme music. Promote your websites and who you are and stuff like that and say, I'm a Nebula nominee and things like that.
I will never say that.
A Nebula nominee.
Visit johnjosephadams.com for free fiction and links to awesome DVD extras from his many anthologies.
And Geek's Guide to the Galaxy.
And Geek Guide to the Galaxy, his podcast.
And visit GenevieveValentine.com for... stuff about all of her great novels and short stories where you can, you know, read them online and to read her great reviews on Questionable Taste Theater.
Good job. Nice.
And OurWolf.com, which has never been nominated for an Academy Award. I think Major Armstrong may have come up at one point. I'm very proud to say that's Big Deal Radio Award. And actually I got two of them. Not for Hour of the Wolf. for other things I've done. But Hour of the Wolf will return to these airwaves on the Ides of March, on March 15th. And we'll have good stuff in March and April. And who knows when the next fundraising drive is? Probably March. I don't know. It's March 1st. How long can we go without that? But you still have a few minutes in which to pledge at 212-209-2950. And a $75 pledge will get you a copy of Under the Moons of Mars, written and edited by our guests of the morning, and also come to the reading at 138 Sullivan Street next Tuesday. Show up at 6:30 so you can partake of cheese and wine, and or you can wine while you're having cheese or whatever. And
or as they call it on Barsoom, cheese and wine.
That's it. That's in the glossary. That's nice. In the glossary. Thank you both. Thank you, Lords and Jeddaks of WBAI, for making this time happen, and Robert Knight. And, well, we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Come in next week for International Working Women's Day at a radio signal near you. Have a great morning. Take care.
Food Bank of America cordially invites you to the grand opening celebration of their first New York City branch on Wednesday, February 29th at 10 a.m. Drop off non-perishable food items at Occupy Wall Street's pop-up occupation at Bryant Park. As part of the F29 Day of Action to shut down the corporations, the Food Bank of America will distribute healthy food outside a Bank of America branch. The message is simple. The banks influence our political system to steal from us, forcing families to choose between paying rent and paying for food. Don't let the banks starve us. Starve the banks. Once again, the event begins at 10 a.m. at Bryant Park, 42nd Street and 5th Avenue.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board will be holding a meeting on Wednesday, February 29th, to discuss your opinions about programming at WBAI. This will be held at the 60 Wall Street Atrium starting at 5:30 p.m. The 60 Wall Street Atrium is in Lower Manhattan in the Financial District, just one block away from the station. Again, February 29th for the WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting to hear your opinions on WBAI programming at the 60 Wall Street Atrium starting at 5:30 p.m.
People of Earth, attention.
We interrupt this alien announcement for the following bullet. Back of the Book, the radio program that convention defies, will return to the air on Saturday, March 3rd at 5 a.m. Join R. Paul Martin and Pickles of the North for 55 minutes of whatever. We now return you to your alien invasion.
Martian black smoke spreading faster. It sweeps Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies.
Are we able to put this year's election in the hands of our young girls? We will when they attend the Women in the Making Politics and Public Service Summit for Girls on Saturday, March 31st from 10:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Held at Metropolitan College of New York, the day's theme is We the People. Wear what most represents who you are and what you believe in. Colors, t-shirts, hats, buttons, etc. The WIM Shiro panel features city council members, urban justice and public affairs advocates who will address understanding political process and how you fit in, contacting them on issues you're passionate about, beginning your career in public service, and more. Breakfast, lunch, goodie swag bags, fun mock debates, and raffle items exploring New York City history and culture. Advance tickets required. Visit brownpapertickets.com and search Women in the Making Politics and Public Service Summit.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spirit, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is the place to turn to.
Peace. Oh my God. My mother got a sleeping suicide singing, oh my God. And my mother got a sleeping genocide singing, oh my God. And my mother got a sleeping suicide singing, oh my God. Oh my God.
Oh yeah.
International Working Women's Day programming on WBAI is Thursday, March 8th and Friday, March 9th. Meetings are now being held. Come and join us. Share your ideas and experiences and bring your voices to the airwaves. Meetings are on Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. and Sundays from 2 to 4 p.m. The last meeting will be held on Sunday, March 4th. To enter the building and to get involved, call 212-209-2800 or email us at iwwdatwbai@gmail.com.
On Sunday, March 4th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature composer and song stylist Diane Reeves. Tune in to hear a little bit about this amazing force in music. That's Sunday, March 4th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.